Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And we are back and ready for another big weekend of MMA. Of course, this week we have all sorts of different content coming out. We also have the interview with Tony Gravely that's already dropped on the channel. He's got a big fight coming up at UFC Fight Night, Whitaker versus Gastelum. This is a fight we were originally supposed to get at UFC 243, and I cannot wait for it. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me, as always, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And Matt, we have plenty of UFC debuts on this card. We have a lot of lesser-known fighters, maybe even making their second or third time out, that have really flown under the radar. This is one of those cards that might not grab all the headlines, but there's a lot of matchups that we're really looking at.
Remember that time Israel Adesanya headlined a card against Anderson Silva? Oh, wait, yeah, that was a real thing that happened. Now, that was supposed to be the co-main event to what we're getting this weekend in the main event. I'm really excited for this fight. I am. We were supposed to get Whitaker against Gastelum for the title. Unfortunately, not for the title, but I do think the stakes are very high in that fight. We have a lot of other very interesting fights up and down this whole card. A lot of names that a lot of people will know, like the Andre Arlovskis of the world, the Jeremy Stevens, and then a lot of new exciting up-and-comers, too. So I think it'll be a very fun card this Saturday.
Big-time heavyweight fight, and it's not the Arlovski fight. You know I've already got this one circled on my calendar as soon as I found out. Matt, let's flip it on over to our fight of the night screen, as always presented by Manscaped. And of course, you gotta make sure you check out manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're gonna save 20% off and get free shipping to help out the boys, but also your balls. But when I look at this fight, Matt, our first pick for fight of the night is our co-main event. And we always try not to cherry pick your main, your co-main. But when you have two names like Jakara Close and Jeremy Stevens, you know both of these guys are going to bring it. For Jeremy Stevens, moving back up to lightweight, and it's been a bit since he's been at 55. Taking on Jakara Close, a guy that was booked against a fellow fighter that's just one slot below him in Luis Pena. That fight fell out a few months ago, and now all of a sudden, he finds himself in there against a really big name with a huge opportunity to kind of springboard himself forward. I get vibes like when Hanato Moicano fought Demir Hadzevich, but what are you thinking about this fight? I think it's going to deliver.
I think this will be a very fun fight, and I know Jeremy Stevens isn't on the best run of his career, but you just have to look at the guys who he's lost to. You can lose to Calvin Kattar and Jose Aldo and Zabit and Yair Rodriguez. Not that big of a deal. Okay, maybe it's not the best sign ever, but those are all very entertaining fights. For Jakara Close, he has one of those styles where really no matter who he's in there with, the fight should be entertaining. Really good boxing, good defensively, just two all-action fighters, and I'm very excited for this coach.
Love this fight. I definitely think it's going to deliver. Let's throw it on over to our other pick. Straight up on this card, we have two guys at heavyweight that are over 40 years old. And Matt, I kind of took the Daniel Tosh looking for Aaron Anderson and I ran with it. Juan Espino calling you out. And I always wanted to see Juan Espino. And then it was 1 year. And then it was a year and a half. And then it was 2 years. And from the fight against Justin Frazier to his last time out against Jeff Hughes, it was forever in my mind. I always wanted to see Juan Espino. Finally, he was back. He looked great in that fight against Jeff Hughes. Now he's taking on an absolute Moldovan buzzsaw in Alexander Romanov. And I consider this one a possible fight of the night because these guys are proven finishers. It's just a little unfortunate, and I won't get into the prediction. We'll just say it's exciting that Juan Espino's only loss is to, well, the 2.0 version of the guy that he lost to.
I'm very excited for this fight. I gotta be honest, I'm more excited for this fight than I am the co-main event, because I truly think Alexander Romanov has a really high ceiling in this division. Now, I understand, you watch him fight and you're thinking, hey, I didn't know WWE moves work in the cage, but they kind of do if you're massive and of Moldovan descent. It works out. And for Romanov, we've really seen him take this style, really unorthodox wrestling style, if you will, and incorporate it with great success into his MMA game. But for Juan Espino, is the ground the best place to go with him? Phenomenal grappler in this heavyweight division. I'm so excited for this fight.
Two incredibly unorthodox chokes in their last fight, so we'll talk about that, but I love this fight, so you gotta make sure you check out manscaped.com, use promo code FNP, you're gonna save 20% off and get free shipping on your order today, and if you don't believe me, tune in later on in the show, I will talk about some ball raising, maybe a little bit of conditioning, we'll see what happens, a ball talks for later on, but I love these fights. It's another big week with Fight Night Picks, and make sure you check out all of the other content on the channel. Like I said at the start, we got a great interview with our own GHK MMA, who's joined by Tony Gravely, who's got a big fight coming up this weekend against Anthony Burchak. We got great content over on the website, the written up interviews. You get the podcast, all sorts of neat articles, the full card betting guides. You can also check out the Fight Night Picks shop. We get some great stuff over there. The merch, the Under Armour hats. Hey, maybe you're getting ready for spring training. Well, spring training's over, but the start of baseball season, the Fight Night Picks baseball jersey, all kinds of great stuff, fightnightpicks.com. Matt, I love this card. I'm really looking forward to it. Whitaker Gastelum in the main, in the co-main event, Dracara Close taking on Jeremy Stephens. You're not going to want to miss any of that. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, Matt,
let's get into it.
Neat fight and a late notice addition to our card as we have a big time banger at bantamweight between a couple of primary grapplers in Tony Gravely taking on El Toro Anthony Burchak. And Matt, for Anthony Burchak, he was a late addition in his last fight. He was taking on Gustavo Lopez. It was on just a few days notice. I was traveling. We did the video in split screen. Couldn't even be in person, but we got the job done. For Anthony Burchak, this is a guy that doesn't really have the greatest record in his last five, let alone his last seven. And if you look at it, he had his first run in the UFC, lost his debut to Ian Entwistle, and he lost it emphatically, very, very quickly. He ended up going 2-2 in the UFC, and then he left on a win. You rarely ever see that, but Burchak was one of those guys. He went over to Ryzen, and then he lost three in a row, and then he ended up winning a few. He comes in here to the UFC, and he just gets absolutely obliterated by Gustavo Lopez. And it was one of those fights that, hey, Anthony Burchak, Division II wrestling, Greco-Roman type of guy. He's got all the grappling credentials in the world. When he came into the UFC the first time, he was a purple belt in jiu-jitsu. He's continued to really grapple with high-level guys. He goes to competition. He's a black belt at this point, trains out of 10th Planet in Tucson. But man, it's like those really, really high-level guys can still kind of beat him. And he's a good wrestler, but the high-level wrestlers can beat him. For Tony Gravely, I mean, an amazing record. A guy with tons of experience outside of the UFC. Oh, yeah. He was one of those fighters that you expected the promotion to sign. He comes in, and it's been an interesting kind of bag for him. Because you look at it, he beats Ray Rodriguez, who just recently got released by the promotion. He loses to Brett Johns in a fight that was ultimately very close. But for Brett Johns, very, very good grappler at 135. Just cue up his heel hook win that he had, or his calf slicer. Whatever you want, Brett Johns, very good grappler. And then if you look at his last fight out, he won a split decision over Geraldo de Freitas. And I'll talk about the takedowns later on. But that is a primary version of Tony Gravely's grappling and his game. He's a guy that comes out of Virginia Tech. He's got great, great wrestling. Trains out of American Top Team now. And that was a main emphasis of his interview with our own JHK MMA. The fact that he's trying to gain some skills and incorporate them into his game from some of the guys he trains with at the gym. And we're talking big, big names. And I hate the name drop, but Tony did, so I will. Adriano Moraes, primary guy he's that okay. He trains with. Pretty good knee over Demetrius Johnson. Can't do that against Anthony Burchak. He also trains with Kyoji Horiguchi and Pedro Munoz as well. You like to hear that. But for Burchak, this is a guy, real vet of the game. I love the matchup because it gives you a good idea of where each guy is in this division.
I do like the matchup. I might not be as hot on it as you are for this reason alone. I don't think Anthony Burchak is going to go on some big run, even if he is able to beat Tony Gravely. And I might be holding his old win, or his old loss, I should say, to Thomas Almeida against him, because that's immediately what I think of when I think of Anthony Burchak. I think of him as that opponent that they brought in to just get absolutely destroyed by Almeida. And that was the situation in that fight. And for Burchak, it is kind of weird because you've seen him lose to different kinds of fighters. Let's say he only lost to primary wrestlers. Then yes, this fight would just be awful for him against Gravely. But the fact that really good strikers can also just create a lot of distance between themselves and Burchak and force him to become a striker, it's kind of weird because he does have the jiu-jitsu credentials. His wrestling's good, but it's weird. He's one of these fighters who his MMA wrestling, I would say, is good but not great, even though you look at his wrestling credentials and you would think, wow, this is one of the better MMA wrestlers out there. But he has been taken down and controlled by some other MMA wrestlers, if you will, and that's not going to pay him all that well against Tony Gravely, because the big knock against Gravely, if anything, is he wrestles too much. He just wrestles and wrestles and wrestles, and he can be one of those fighters who, okay, well, you stuffed my double leg, and now you stuffed my double leg again. He'll really start to fatigue as the fight goes on, and you are starting to stuff those double legs. I'm not going to compare him totally to, like, a Marco Madsen. Where's he at, first of all? Because I'd love to see him back in the UFC.
Doing talk shows overseas.
There you go. I learned something new. But Gravely is one of those fighters who, if he does wrestle a little bit too much, he does kind of need to find that proper zone. He can't wrestle too much to where he's exhausted in that third round, and some of the submission ability of Burchak might be incorporated into this fight, but he can't just keep this fight on the outside and try to strike. It's not that Gravely is a poor striker by any means. Defensively, though, he does have a few lapses, and when he does lunge in with his strikes, because that's the big problem with Gravely, he's such this high power athlete that when he does move forward, similar to his takedown attempts along with his punches, he will put everything behind them. And when he does fight those upper echelon strikers who have good takedown defense in this division, think of guys like, you know, Corey Sandhagen, if you will, kind of up the ladder a little bit, they will give him troubles. But the thing that I really like that you said about his training partners at American Top Team is this: everyone you named has a different style. Pedro Munoz, great at jiu-jitsu, but he's got good kickboxing. Horiguchi has great boxing and kickboxing, but he's also a good wrestler. All those fighters have all these different wrinkles of their MMA games that I do think Tony Gravely can pick up on. And if you can incorporate striking and maybe a little bit better cardio along with his dominant wrestling, I do think we'll have a really good fighter here in Tony Gravely.
And for Gravely, it's going to be kind of important because you look at him, he's a short, not stocky guy, but he's a short guy for the division. Burchak's one of the taller guys. And if you're Gravely and just about every day you're training with the 7 foot tall bantamweight that is Adriano Moraes, it's going to be nice to go in there in the cage against a guy like Burchak and be somewhat familiar with it. But I really wanted to give you those numbers. He had 3 takedowns against Rodriguez. He had 5 against Brett Johns. He had 7 against DeFreitas. That's insane. Now, he's one of those guys that likes to get on top and he wants to be heavy on top. I know we talked about that with JHK, but you can obviously tell that from any of the fights that you see. Against DeFreitas, 7 takedowns, that's a high number. You're not getting a lot of time on top and getting that position. It'll be interesting to see how he makes out. I mean, he averages like 5.6 per fight, so it'll be interesting to see how the takedown defense of Burchak is, because you know that that's going to be the game plan from Gravely.
And the thing about Burchak, too, is with his submission ability, you kind of look at the cardio issues of Gravely. Stylistically, this should play into Burchak's hand, but my real issue is I don't know if he can get up off the bottom like we saw Geraldo de Freitas do, like we have seen some of Gravely's opponents do. When Gravely is really heavy on top, yeah, there isn't always a lot of action going on. He can make fights somewhat stale, if you will, but it is effective. And when he is able to get on top of guys, for the most part, unless you are one of those other top-tier wrestlers and grapplers, not saying that Burchak isn't, but again, we have seen his MMA wrestling might not be the great. I do see this being a very top-control-heavy fight for Tony Gravely.
Interesting thing before we flip it on over to the odds. For the guy in Burchak, who's originally supposed to fight a guy that was on UFC 2 and 3 and 4 in Johnny Eduardo, that fight fell out. So Burchak, it seemed like he was still going to fight on the pay-per-view, and then they kind of moved it around, and now he's here. For Tony Gravely, who's supposed to fight this weekend against Nate Maness, what does Anthony Burchak do that's any better than Nate Maness at this point in his career? It's pretty tough.
Yeah, it really is. And again, I think this fight, I don't know if we're going to get a clear contender from this, but for Gravely, it will be interesting to see. If he goes out here and wins this fight in a way that we might have not expected, let's say his striking does look a lot better. He is able to tie his kicks in a little bit with his takedown attempts, and maybe the striking into the clinch work of Tony Gravely has improved. If we see those things from him, then maybe we could see him go on, I'm not saying a run to the top 10, but we might see him eventually be in there with some guys who are ranked, but I think this will be a really entertaining fight.
He could have Burchak playing spoiler as well, some of his defensive submissions, but if we have a look at the odds, it's fairly cut and dry. Gravely opened a -205 favorite, though. That line dropped significantly. He's now -320. And if you look at Burchak, he opened a +175. He's now at a +260 or thereabouts. Matt, the surprise for us all, we're going to bring up the Tapology votes. Ooh, boy. 946 of them, 91% Gravely, 57% by decision. I'm in agreement with the fans. I'm in agreement with the odds. I'm going with Gravely as well. I mean, again, we normally lay it out a little bit more, you know, for both guys, but for Burchak, we've seen him dominated by some primary wrestlers. And if you look at that win streak, yeah, there's some good wins. I mean, Adam Martinez, he finishes him. He finishes Rafael Montini de Lima, who was 6-2 at the time, and Eric Radlum coming into the UFC at 5-5. But it was quite a while ago. It's not the highest level competition. Exactly. And if you look at it for Gravely, the 5-on-in, we don't even have to focus on the 5-on-in. He beat a very, you know, well-known up-and-comer that wasn't Ray Rodriguez, Draco Rodriguez, down with, you know, another big promotion in King of the Cage. So for me, I've got Gravely in this one. I think his game plan will be implemented quite well against a guy like Burchak. Is that what you're thinking?
No, I do agree. I think Burchak might have a little bit of success in the grappling department, but round after round, I do just think the physical presence of Gravely might wear down on Burchak to the point where, yeah, Gravely might be tired in that third round, but if Burchak's constantly defending takedowns and trying to get up off his back, he'll also be pretty tired by that third round, so no, I agree. I like Gravely.
Both of us going with Tony Gravely to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. Our co-main event, a big one between Jakar Close and Jeremy Stephens. In the main event, Robert Whittaker taking on Kelvin Gastelum. Finally, really looking forward to it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Interesting fight at women's bantamweight that's probably going to open some eyes this weekend. We have Brazil's Josiane Nunes making her UFC debut, and she's taking on France's Zara Farron. And while some people might be familiar with Farron, she came into the UFC with a little bit of fanfare. She was France's first woman in the UFC. And since then, all the fanfare is gone and she's dropped down a weight class. Listen, she lost her debut to Megan Anderson in the Big House. It was Marvel Stadium. She got finished in the first round. So she goes out there last year and she fights Canada's Felicia Spencer. And the Canadian was able to withstand the early storm. They struck, they traded. Farron had a little bit of success. And then Felicia Spencer went, well, you have no ground game. I'm taking you down. I'm going to get in mount. I'm going to hammer away at your face. And for Farron, she didn't really have much of an answer. But Felicia Spencer, very heavy on top, landed some good elbows too. Referee saw enough. For Zara Farron, she's a primary boxer. And she is a little bit heavy on her tippy toes. Like, she weighs heavy ahead. She moves ahead quite well. She will throw in combination. But she leaves a lot of weight on her front foot, and listen, she doesn't throw much for kicks. She doesn't really have much of a clinch game from what we've seen in the UFC, but we did see it on the regional scene that her clinch game could be effective. She can use her cardio as a weapon, which I worry about a little bit. She's 34 right now in this bantamweight division, but if Holly Holm can still do it, then hey, who knows what's going to happen. Like I said, she's taking on Brazil's Josiane Nunes. And I've watched a lot of her fights. There's a lot of tape out there. It might not be the best shot stuff, but you can find it out there. She's a Muay Thai expert. She's a southpaw. She is gotta be the shortest bantamweight in this division. She's 5'2". She stands really low. She throws a lot of power kicks. She looks like she's tired from the first second of the fight. She throws in combination. She's got power on single shots. But the best thing that Josiane Nunes does, it's something that Andrei Arlovsky does well up on top of this card. She will blitz forward and land with power. And once she backs her opponents up to the fence, it's, to steal a phrase from Michael Schiavello, it's good night, Irene.
Stylistically, this should be a really fun fight, because for Zara Farron, we've seen her in her two UFC fights. They have not gone her way, and the holes that we did see exposed, it was in the grappling. And now, I don't think Josiane Nunes is going to go out shooting double legs or wearing a wrestling shoes to this fight. So stylistically, I do think entertainment-wise, at least, we should get a very fun fight here. For me, I do think you can somewhat simplify this fight into, can Josiane Nunes get on the inside of Zara Farron? And I don't want to say that's easier said than done, because I do think you can get on the inside of someone like Farron. And the reason I say that is because we've seen fighters, they can close the distance on her. Yes, they've used that distance management, I guess, for takedown attempts, but if you get on the inside, you can work her body and to the head. And the interesting thing about Nunes, and you kind of brought it up, stylistically, and at least physically, she is built a lot like Jessica Andrade when Andrade used to fight at 135. Stylistically, might not be as similar, whereas Andrade, she gets a little bit more wild with her techniques. She'll throw hard to the body, hard to the head, whereas Nunes can keep things a lot more technical. For me, if Nunes can stick with low leg kicks and throw overhands to make Farron pay for her single shots, I really do think she can replicate a somewhat successful gameplay. For me, it will be interesting because you, again, as someone mentioned it, the clinch game of Zara. If she is able to clinch up, get a nice Muay Thai clinch, and throw knees up the middle, those are going to be really hard for Nunes all night. But the problem with that is going to be Nunes is going to be able to throw all those body shots and really get on the inside that much easier.
The plum clinch is actually Josiane Nunes' best position. It's even against taller opponents, that's been her best position.
But at a certain point, there will kind of be a point of diminishing returns. And against a fighter like Farron, just stylistically, you're not going to be able to get that clinch on her. Yes, she will be able to close that distance and really, again, this fight comes down to distance management. If Nunes can get on the inside, Farron really only throws punches. And if you can get inside on a puncher, they're not going to throw that many elbows, and you're going to be able to go to work on their body and to the head. As Teddy Atlas says, if you're fighting a skyscraper, you got to start taking out windows. And for Nunes, that's going to be the key. You got to go for the legs, and you got to go for the body in this fight.
To me, this is a Timmins Saturday night special. And if you're Shania Twain from Timmins, That don't impress me much. This is one of those fights that I don't have high hopes for it, and you're absolutely insane if you have this on one of your cards. So let's focus on Josiane Nunes a little bit more. We'll break it out. She got signed to the UFC a little bit ago. She's an MTK fighter. She's been signed with them for some time. And again, very much a Muay Thai fighter. It's not just because she wears the Thai trunks. You see it in her training. You see it from where she's coming from. She's out of Striker's house. But this is the really interesting thing. You look at these two records. From Nunes, the one loss, it's against Tyler Santos. Okay, that's going to happen. Go over to her Instagram, see where she's training out of. I said Striker's house, and it is primarily there, but she also spends time at Astra Fight Team with Viviani Paheia. Maybe didn't have the best run in the UFC, but still
good training.
Was UFC caliber. Fought really good names, actually. And Tyler Santos trains there, so they all train together. I love that for Nunes, who, again, you watch these fights and you go, geez, I can't get a read on her. And honest to goodness, it is hard to get a read on her. The one thing that I really don't like is the fact that she is a fish out of water when it comes to wrestling and grappling. She is bad at it.
We have two of those, Craig.
Exactly. She gets taken down very easy and controlled. If you go back and you watch her second to last fight with Dione Barboza, that was a fight where Barboza had Danilo Marquez in her corner. She gets her down. She stays on top. And then Barboza starts to get a little bit tired. And then in the very end, it's classic Nunes. She's just going in there and hammering away and then finishes the fight. She did the same thing in her last fight against Zbonic. And she did it in the fight before that against Araujo, who was coming in there, pro debut for her. They struck. And the really weird thing about that one was you had Nunes who held Araujo in just a guillotine up against the cage. And Araujo was a lot taller. You'd think with a taller opponent, geez, that'd be pretty easy to get out of, but it wasn't. And I'm not joking. 4.5 minutes of my life were spent watching Nunes hold that in. Then the second round comes out, Araujo's tired, and she gets finished by Nunes. So for Nunes, not the highest level of competition, good striker. Zara Fern, an early loss. Sinead Kavanaugh.
No shame.
No shame. I mean, Bellator vet. People in Europe, very high on Sinead Kavanaugh. Good boxer. That's fine. Split decision loss. And then if you look at it, the win to get into the UFC, UFC vet Isabella Badurek. And it was one fight. And if I'm not mistaken, she fought Alexandra Albu. I'm pretty sure that's all it was. But there's a really weird kind of thing here. They're both strikers. One throws kicks. One's way shorter than the other. And for Zara Farron, she's making the drop down from featherweight, where in her first fight with Megan Anderson, I know they said this on the broadcast, Zara Farron's one of the only fighters you're going to find on the face of planet Earth that can match Megan Anderson's size in the cage.
I got no idea who's going to win this fight, Craig. I'm going to be very honest with you. From what I've seen of Zara Farron, it hasn't been good. Let's just call it what it is. Yes, she had a few decent strikes against Felicia Spencer, but the majority of her game, at least in the UFC up until this point, has been her controlled on bottom position. I'm going to ever so slightly pick Nunes in this fight. Not because I'm overly confident, just because, again, my knowledge of both fighters is somewhat limited compared to the majority of other fighters on this card. But it will be interesting, because personally, Farron had to make that drop down to 135. You really don't see a future of the 145 division, at least I don't in the UFC, and I really don't see her stringing together wins to eventually fighting Nunes at that point. So I do think if this fight is anything, it's an indication that the women's 145-pound division is probably going to get closed relatively soon. But yeah, I'll pick Josiane Nunes, but ever so slightly.
Nunes opened a minus 170. She's now a minus 130 for Zara Farron, ever so slightly the underdog at this point. She opened a plus 145. She's now a plus 106. The money's coming in on Farron, and again, like you said, she did take on the higher level of competition. If you look at the picks over on Tapology, 889 of them, 82% Nunes, 61% by knockout. A little bit of recency bias, I would say.
Yeah, a lot of people thinking she's going to get the knockout. I doubt it's going to be like that. I do see it, though. Her picking apart Farron on the outside. You mentioned it. She is heavy on her front toes. And if you do have a good Muay Thai fighter, and that's what we're dealing with Nunes, she should be able to just chop away at that front leg and get whatever pop there is in Zara Farron's shots out of her punches. And I do see Nunes picking up the decision win.
I mean, it is a weird one. Like I said, I would keep this off my card. And if you come back in the comment section,
is this the Jorgen De Castro versus Jarjus Danhill of this card?
Oh, Matt, I've got those queued up in my notes for later on. But this is one of those ones. It's just so weird. If there's pop and popcorn fights, then this is like, I don't know, tree bark and sap. If you could put those together, it's a weird one. It's not one that I'm honest to goodness looking forward to, but we made it this far. Like I said, it's a weird Tim and Saturday night type of fight. It don't impress me much. I'll go with Nunes as well. Again, I do like the kick game. I like the fact that Farron will push a pace. How's she going to deal with a smaller opponent? How's the weight cut going to be? We have seen her on her Instagrams and her respective socials working her grappling and her jiu-jitsu. Maybe we see that in this fight. But yeah, I just see Nunes, if she's going to be able to out-volume and out-strike, keep it low, throw those kicks, and really slow down Farron, it'll be an interesting night. But Farron's got a decent opportunity, and that's why you can see the gamblers going with Farron. I'm going to go with, the popular attitude, and from what I saw in the tape study, and trust me, I could go on for hours about this fight, but we need to move on. I'm going Nunes. You're going Nunes. It's an interesting card full of some very interesting fights. My personal favorite, Romanov and Espino. And in our main event, you got Whitaker taking on Gastelum. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Low-key, one of my favorite fights on this card. You might say, hey, Craig, why are you being such a hipster? I actually really, really like this stylistic matchup. You have Austin Thud Hubbard looking to make up for his last time out, losing to Joe Selecki, who low-key has a really high ceiling. He's taking on one of the worst nicknames or best nicknames in the sport. You have Dakota Harry Bush. And for Harry Bush, he's coming into this fight on short notice, replacing Natan Levy, who had a big win over on Contender Series. It's not Dan, it's not Eugene, it was Natan. Unfortunate that we don't get that fight out of the Israeli fighter, but a lot of people might be familiar with Dakota Bush. And you probably know him from, well, his fight against Bryce Logan, or maybe his fight against Jaleel Willis. I like Jaleel Willis. He's a great guy to have with Bellator at 170 pounds. And that's the thing, for a lot of the fights that Dakota Bush has had in the lower promotions, and by lower, LFA is not very low, but it's lower than where he's at now. His opponents have missed weight. Jaleel Willis missed weight in their fight. Austin Clem missed weight in his last fight. And if you know Austin Clem, well, he really lit the fire, or at least extinguished the fire, of one Aaron Chalmers. So you look at it for Bush. He took on Clem. He finished him quickly. You look at the fight that he really struggled in. It was the one against Willis. First round, Bush probably won it. I had Bush winning it. Round two, Willis just completely out-wrestles him and gets him to the mat. Third round, all Willis, same thing, 29-28. I know in that fight, after watching a lot of Dakota Bush interviews, was that that's the one that he really thinks about a lot. He was disappointed with his wrestling performance. So went out there and trained that exclusively. And if you look over on, you know, the respective socials, he trains at a couple of different gyms. But I've seen it recently. He's at Westside MMA in Little Rock training with TJ Brown, who's got a big fight coming up, training with Bryce Mitchell. You like to see stuff like that out of a guy for Dakota Bush, that mainly he strikes to wrestle, but he strikes to strike, and this guy throws tons of power into his strikes.
And that's what makes this fight so fun, because for Austin Hubbard, a really good counter striker, and we have seen him struggle with the offensive wrestling himself, so that's why I'm really excited for this fight. We've seen both guys struggle against at least stylistically similar opponents, and then we've seen both guys thrive against, well, really the fighters that they're fighting this weekend, and that's why I'm so excited. I'm going to throw this wrinkle in, though. The last win that we saw Austin Hubbard get was against Max Roshkoff. Now, Max didn't really belong in that fight. We did kind of figure that out afterwards. I don't think this is going to be one of those matchups, but I am going to throw that out there. Every time you do have someone first joining the UFC and they're fighting someone who does have that experience edge, even if Austin Hubbard hasn't had the best run in the UFC, he's still been in there with good opponents. And you bring it up with Joe Selecki. I thought Hubbard was going to win that fight. I did. I didn't know Joe Selecki was the absolute monster on the mat that he turned out to be.
Miller 2.0.
He really is. Now, is he as exciting as maybe a prime Jim Miller was? Well, no, but the results do speak for themselves, and he is undefeated because of that style, and you look at what he was able to do to Austin Hubbard. Once he gets him to the ground, it's pretty much over from that point. Gets his way to his back, dominates him from there. The thing I do like about Austin Hubbard is he actually does kind of well against wrestlers. He is a good example of a fighter who, yes, his takedown defense isn't always great, but he can outlast a lot of primary wrestlers. And when we talked about kind of how Tony Gravely is one of those fighters who he can wrestle himself into exhaustion, those are the fighters who Austin Hubbard can have success against. He does have a really good gas tank himself. He can keep a high volume throughout a fight, and he's a fighter who can go a hard 15 minutes. And I'm even going to bring up the Marco Madsen loss, because that was a fight where I did think Austin Hubbard gained stock even in losing, because that fight to me was very similar to when Nina Ansaroff fought Tatiana Suarez, where you have this one overpowering wrestler versus kind of the jack of all trades on the other side. We saw, yeah, Austin Hubbard struggled a lot against that wrestling in the first two rounds, but in the third round, once he was able to stuff some of those takedown attempts from the Olympic champion in Marco Madsen, he was piecing them up on the feet and having really good success. So for Hubbard, a lot of his success in the UFC is just from getting his back off the cage. He's one of those fighters who the easiest way to take down Austin
Austin Hubbard is not in the middle of the cage. He has great footwork, and he can use his feet to get out of trouble. The best way to take down Austin Hubbard is close that cage off and make it small for him, because if he is able to use his movement, he can just kind of run around you for a lot of the fight. So what two things you really have to do when you fight Austin Hubbard is A, work on the legs, and I'm sure you can speak about some of the injuries Austin Hubbard's had to his legs, or try to wrestle him. And again, that's what makes this fight really fun. Could Dakota Bush go out there and use some of his new grappling, I guess, attributes that he's acquired throughout his training? I'm sure he can, but what this fight at its most exciting should be is just two strikers going out there trying to take each other's heads off.
I can't wait to see the offensive upgrades from Dakota Bush on the mat, because his offensive wrestling is very good. His footwork's really slick. He's got a nice wide stance, but he kind of moves his shoulders around. He keeps his head off the center line.
To quote Joe Rogan, if you saw a silhouette of Dakota Bush fighting, you would know that's Dakota Bush.
Dakota Bush does fight in a really interesting way, so I'm really excited to see how he makes out in a fight like this. For Hubbard, though, again, 2-3 in his UFC run, he loses to Davi Hamosh. Pretty good wrestler, very good at jiu-jitsu. Oh. He beats Kyle Prepelec, and then he gets compartmentalization syndrome in his calf, so that's kind of gross. He loses to Madsen. The interesting part, loses the first round, loses the second round, wins the third round. And he always has that lasting cardio. Then in his next fight, he beats Max Roshkoff. But similar to the Chris Gutierrez-Cody Durden fight, the first round, listen, it was all Durden in the Gutierrez fight. The first round was Max Roshkoff, and he looked good. The second round, he fell off a cliff. So that's how that one went. And then you had the Joe Selecki fight where Selecki backpacked him. And then as soon as he kind of started sinking in, we end up on the mat and Selecki gets the choke. So it'll be interesting to see for Hubbard, what's he been able to add to his game? Because I've seen from recent interviews, he had one with James Lynch with Pub Sports Radio. I noticed another one came out today. I'm going to have to go back and watch it. But it's kind of the same theme. Austin Hubbard, training with Justin Gaethje, working at Team Elevation, working with a mental coach to kind of come over some of these obstacles. It'll be interesting. Working some of these obstacles, it'll be interesting to see what we get out of Austin Hubbard in a fight like this. Because again, this is a well-matched one. It just depends how good is this prospect coming in here against a former LFA champ and a UFC vet of five fights.
No, I couldn't agree more. And for me, I'm going to be really curious to see how much Dakota Bush does decide to wrestle, because let's say the first round isn't going well for him. Well, we know that the cardio of Austin Hubbard's going to hold up throughout those 15 minutes, no matter what kind of an output he is throwing. So for Bush, it will be interesting to see if he starts out shooting for takedowns in the first round, and if Hubbard is able to defend those first few takedowns, I do expect it going in Hubbard's direction as the fight progresses. For Bush, I think he has to get off to a very, very good start, and hopefully just try to damage Hubbard to the point where that lasting cardio won't be as effective in that later third round, because one of the few things I can guarantee is if this fight does make it to a third round, I do like Austin Hubbard's chances to at least win that third. He is a fighter who maybe his output isn't like Tony Ferguson, where we see this massive uptick as he progresses, but I know he passes the eye test when it comes to cardio. I've seen him in hard fights where in that third round he is still throwing, and that really does mean a lot.
For Austin Hubbard, and again, this fight was just announced on Monday night, he's a minus 175 favorite. The line hasn't moved a whole lot. For Dakota Bush, Harry Bush, plus 145. If we look at the Tapology votes, going to be a limited sample size, 534 of them, 77% Hubbard, 84% by decision. For the 23% that have Bush to win, 46% by submission, it's a definite possibility. And I do like Dakota Bush as far as a fighter's concerned. He's been a guy that's cornered some UFC fighters. Yes, heavyweight Jake Collier, he has cornered before, so he's worn the UFC colors.
What about middleweight Jake?
He's a guy that comes out of Cuba, Missouri. Matt, I did my research for this one. Do you know what they have in Cuba, Missouri? Well,
no.
3,000 people, just about. They have the Wagon Wheel Motel, formerly the biggest rocking chair in the world. It now belongs to a town in Illinois, and it's 4 miles outside of Cuba, but all kinds of stuff that you just didn't know before.
I didn't.
As far as this fight's concerned, I like the experience factor in this one from Hubbard. So I will ever so slightly go with Hubbard, but if there's an opportunity for a finish in this one, it's Dakota Bush's.
I don't know about that. I do think Austin Hubbard could finish Dakota Bush. Again, I'm not predicting a similar fight to Roshkoff, but if Hubbard is able to defend those early takedowns and really have that uptick in volume in that second and third round, we might be able to see a TKO from Hubbard in the later rounds of this fight. But for me, I do like Hubbard by decision. I do think he will be able to defend those takedowns of Dakota Bush. And if Bush does fatigue himself going for those takedowns, well, you're just going to be a fish out of water in that second and third round against a guy with really good volume, really good combinations in Austin Hubbard. I like Hubbard in this one.
Matt, we're both going with Thud Austin Hubbard to get the win. Really looking forward to the fight in the short notice arena. It should be a good one. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say. Let's get into it. Really interesting fight, and I'm serious about this one. We have a crossroads fight at middleweight, and I don't think it's out of the question to say that it's a crossroads fight. We have Poland's The Butcher, Bartosz Fabinski, a guy that trains at a WCA with the likes of Jan Blachowicz and Marian Zielkowski, and some of the bigger guys training out of Poland, and he's taking on Rufus Sports, GM3, Gerald Meerschaert, and Matt. For both of these guys, they are ground fighters and grapplers at the highest level. For Bartosz Fabinski, you know how high level his judo is. And listen, you have Judo Thunder on the main card with Abdul Razak Al-Hassan. But there's a close second with Fabinski. And for Gerald Meerschaert, very good at defensive submissions. If I've ever seen anybody that looked like Alton Lister in a basketball game, Khamzat Chimaev went full Sean Kemp over poor old Gerald Meerschaert in Meerschaert's last campaign. Listen, he's 2-3 in his last five. The losses aren't really the best. He lost a split to Eric Anders. Sometimes that's going to happen. He also lost by finish against Bangkok Reddy, Ian Heinisch. And that's going to happen too. The Chimaev one's tough, but they had him ranked against or set to take on a number three ranked welterweight. So for Meerschaert, you're coming into a fight with, I'd say, lower expectations than normal. How high could expectations ever be on Gerald?
No, that's a good point. And I think we are two of the bigger Gerald Meerschaert fans out there.
I'd say fans.
Maybe not fans, but just apologists, if you will. I do think Gerald Meerschaert is a good MMA fighter. I really do, because he offers a fighter a lot of different looks. And just he's kind of good at everything. And yeah, you talk about his jiu-jitsu. The wrestling might not be great. I don't think the striking of Gerald Meerschaert is terrible. I don't. And look at his win against Duran Nguyen. His striking was the thing that set up the submission to beat Nguyen. Go back and look at that fight. He's getting absolutely dominated on the feet, because here's the one thing I will say. Gerald Meerschaert is slow. He is slower than molasses on a cold winter day, to quote all the old people in our lives throughout just the majority of my life. But it's true. Gerald Meerschaert, speed is something he has a problem with. You look at a lot of his losses in the UFC. Yeah, he's lost to guys like Khamzat Chimaev, like Thiago Santos, like really high-level fighters. But those are all fighters who are much faster than him. Even Ian Heinisch, the thing that gave Gerald Meerschaert trouble in that fight, I thought if anything was going to give him trouble, it would be the takedown defense of Heinisch, and he would force Meerschaert to become a striker. Well, no, Ian Heinisch went out there, kicked his front leg a bunch, hit him with an overhand, and that was about it. Speed is a problem for Gerald Meerschaert, and at 33 years of age, he might be 33, but in MMA years, he is quite a bit older than that. He's been in a lot of hard fights throughout his career, but this fight for me comes down to one thing. Can Meerschaert get on top of Fabinski? Whether he does that through a reversal of one of Fabinski's takedown attempts, whether he gets onto a guillotine and maybe forces Fabinski to go to his back to roll out of it, those are really the only places I see Meerschaert winning this fight. Because on paper, this fight is just going to be a lot of Fabinski taking down Meerschaert over and over and over and probably over again up against the cage. If you're just asking for an X's and O's of this fight, I see Fabinski probably getting over five takedowns. But the real question comes down to, can Meerschaert get one of those defensive submissions on the way down, or can he reverse and sweep Fabinski from bottom?
For Bartosz Fabinski, he only loses to Brazilian grapplers. If you want to look at his last five fights, that's the funny thing, because for the 5-on-in for both these guys, for Gerald Meerschaert, his fifth to last fight was a year and 8 months ago. For Bartosz Fabinski, it was 5 years and 4 months ago. The guy had a lot of layoffs. And if you look at it, I remember Fabinski for his UFC debut. He fought Gareth McLennan, and he beat the shit out of him.
It was bad.
He beat him bad. And then you look at the last five. He beats Hector Urbina. Forgettable.
Not good.
He beats Emil Mack. That was a good win. It really was.
A billion times.
He loses to Michelle Prezeris, a guy who has a fight coming up. He beats Darren Stewart, and then he loses to Muniz. He beat the brakes off Darren Stewart.
He did.
That fight wasn't even close. So if you want a really good idea of Bartosz Fabinski, we talk about these fighters as a position over submission. Fabinski's all position. And then once he gets to position, it's kind of like, okay, well, I'm here. Do I submit him? Do I start punching him? Like, it's like he kind of gets confused. And at the single second where he gets confused, sometimes it gives the other fighter a chance to get up. When he fought Andrea Muniz, I'm going to take him down. And then we end up in this clinch position, and then I'm going to just sink deeper for the takedown, and then Muniz gets him into a submission. It ends up on the mat, and then Fabinski tries to get up, and he gets an arm, and it's, well, it was a triangle, and then he gets his arm, and he gets the armbar win. Gerald Meerschaert can do all of those things that Muniz did. It's going to be a really interesting one. I mean, both of these guys, it's funny. Fabinski, less fight, older guy.
Exactly.
Meerschaert, older in fight years. Rufus Sport, one of the main guys as far as grappling's concerned. I love the fight because it's judo against jiu-jitsu. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
One thing that I really like about Gerald Meerschaert is that even if he didn't fight in MMA, he would still have a job in MMA. Like, Gerald Meerschaert, I don't want to say he's one of the unsung heroes of MMA, but he really does have one of those jobs where, like, he's the grappling trainer at Rufus Sport. He probably doesn't have to fight. Like, he's just a really good trainer. They like having him around. He's good for the guys there. And when guys go to Rufus Sport, for the longest time it was, you went there only for striking. That's all they would ever offer. Well, Gerald Meerschaert's really shown that guys at Rufus Sport can show a little bit more. They are decent grapplers. They are decent wrestlers. There is more than just a striking camp there. So for Meerschaert, I think we are going to see a little bit of his striking in this fight. I do think he will be able to defend some of the takedowns of Fabinski. I know that's weird, because for Meerschaert, you might assume, well, oh, he kind of wants to get taken down throughout this fight. But one thing I do think Meerschaert will be able to do over Fabinski is, if he can defend some takedowns early, the gas tank of Meerschaert is not terrible. Now, it's not great. I know he said he's slow. He doesn't have the best output in the world. But he is a consistent fighter round between round. And the thing about Fabinski is, he can come very takedown heavy in that first round, and if he's not getting a lot of them, you can force him to become not a primary striker by any means, but he will strike with you a little bit more on the outside, and that will give you an opportunity to hurt him. Now, I will say this, I think Fabinski is probably going to win this fight. I think he will get a lot of takedowns and probably just completely out-wrestle Meerschaert, but Meerschaert is going to have those Paul Craig areas to win this fight, and that's the thing that you have to watch out for.
If you look at this fight, and this might be a surprise to a lot of people, Gerald Meerschaert's tied for number one in middleweight history with most submission wins. He's got five of them. He is tied with Shoeface, Talis Laettes, Rusamir Paulharas, and Damian Maia. How crazy is that? All of them with five. He could break the record here this weekend. If we have a look at the odds, Matt, Bartosz Fabinski opened -150. He's now -134. So Fabinski still the favorite. The money coming on in on Meerschaert, who opened +130. He's now +109. And again, I like the defensive submission abilities from Meerschaert. From Bartosz Fabinski, it's 1A or it's 1B, and that's what scares me away from him. So for me, I'm going to do the cheap one. I'm going to do the cop-out. I'm going to do over 1.5
on the
fight.
Who's your pick, Craig?
Don't care. Do an over 1.5, and that's my official pick.
I'll pick Bartosz Fabinski. I like the wrestling advantage. My problem is, Meerschaert is so good at jiu-jitsu, but he does lack the transition of wrestling to really get on top of a lot of guys. And the places that we have seen Meerschaert have success is, if he can hit his opponents to the ground, get a knockdown, maybe a stun, then he can get a drop. And then we can see him really work his jiu-jitsu on the ground. The wrestling has been a problem. Now, yes, even go back to the Ryan James fight. He was on his back in that fight, and he was able to get his submission. But a lot of his submissions off his back aren't to the level of grappler as Bartosz Fabinski. I think if Fabinski can at least stay out of the full guard of Gerald Meerschaert, he can avoid some of those submissions. So I like Fabinski in this fight.
I also like Fabinski. I'm still going over 1.5 in my own life. We're both going with Poland's Bartosz Fabinski to get the win. Really interesting fight, and it is a crossroads at middleweight. So you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, because in our main event, big time middleweight banger, you have Kelvin Gastelum taking on Robert Whittaker. Let's keep it locked in, and as we always say, let's get into it. If you were a kid that grew up in Canada in the 80s and 90s, or maybe you're in the States and you had Nickelodeon, you might recognize the name Fred Penner. And Fred's big song was, "The Cat Came Back," the very next day. Well, the cat came back. Thought he was gone, but the cat came back. He just couldn't stay away. And in this case, the cat is Jessica Penne. For Jessica Penne, she hasn't fought in years. Years! She had that wild USADA suspension that was not really her fault, kind of.
It was weird.
She had fights booked. She was supposed to fight Jodi Escobel a few years ago. She was also supposed to fight Hannah Goldie not that long ago. They rebooked it for this card. Goldie couldn't make it. Originally tested positive for COVID. She's out this week as well. In steps the Mexican-Canadian Lupita Lupi Godinez. And Matt, I'm telling you, for this week, I watched a lot of tape that was outside of the UFC, outside of the Bellators and the big promotions of the world. Now, for Lupi, her last fight was over with LFA. Before that, with BTC, right up here in Canada. And listen, I'm not lying about this. This is the prospect that I'm most excited to watch on this card. Holy smokes, have I been impressed by Lupi Godinez. She does so many things well in the cage. And if you wanted to get a good idea of how she matches up in a fight like this, and I'm going to hand it over to you when we talk about Jessica Penne, because we just got done talking about Jessica Penne, where she's supposed to fight Goldie. But Jessica Penne, early on, good striker, very well-rounded, but her grappling was really her bread and butter. And for Lupi Godinez in her last fight, it was for the LFA strawweight title, and she fought a fighter that I know the UFC wishes they had and Vanessa Demopoulos. And we've seen her with LFA, and we've seen her with some of the bigger promotions, bigger regional promotions. We saw her on Contender Series, and it just never seems to be the right moment for Vanessa Demopoulos. But what's she good at? Some of the same things that Jessica Penne's good at, and Lupi Godina has boxed her ears in the first three rounds. Forget about the fourth and the fifth. And I did think that Lupi won the fight. I actually scored one of the rounds 10-8 for Godina's in that original three-round set. But holy smokes, really good footwork. Comes out of Titan MMA in Vancouver. She's been training a little bit in Colorado for this one. Her boxing is so good. You go back and watch the BTC fight, her second to last fight. She took on a recognizable name who came in on short notice in Lindsay Garbat. And listen, kudos to Lindsay. She's always there for a fight. She's taking on really good competition. And her cardio's great. Lupi looked like she hadn't even been in a fight at the end of it. Barely a scratch on her face. Now, the Vanessa Demopoulos one, look at a side-by-side of both of their faces. They had a war. But for Godinez, good takedown defense. When she was on top, or if she ever got into any bad spots, she was able to get out of them. Vanessa Demopoulos put her in that crazy kind of triangle that she got Sam Hughes in. Godinez was able to get out of it. Really, really like the game of, again, the Canadian-Mexican fighter that's fought for Combate in the past, that fought for LFA, the former champ. It's a really tough ask to come in on short notice and take on such a big name like Jessica Penne. It'll be really interesting to see what Jessica Penne even looks like in this fight.
Is it a tough ask, Craig? Now, I know we like to say, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all. So okay. I'm just going to throw out some facts. I'm just going to throw out a few things that we know are true. It's been 3 years and 11 months since the last time Jessica Penne has been in a cage. No lies detected. I'm glad we can all agree. She lost to Danielle Taylor. Now, my problem is that Danielle Taylor, along with some of the names you had mentioned, like Hannah Cyphers, like Hannah Goldie, those are what you kind of consider those entry-level UFC names. Is, oh, we have this prospect, that's a good person for them to fight in their UFC debut. The fact that Jessica Penne has a loss to one of those types of fighters almost 4 years ago is a little bit concerning. And Jessica Penne is kind of weird. Now, I'm going to compare her to just a lot of different fighters in this video, so please bear with me. I'm going to compare her a little bit to Arturo Gatti, because Jessica Penne, it seemed like she did a lot of the great things in her career before we ever really get to see her at the greatest point of her career. We saw, at least the UFC tenure, that's kind of post-prime Jessica Penne, if you will. Her prime was spent in Invicta at Atomweight. So now we're dealing with a fighter who wasn't really in their prime in their UFC run, and now they're 4 years removed from even that. I'm very confused as to why the UFC still has Jessica Penne, if I'm being very honest. I understand they do like her for her part outside of the cage. She does some work with Angela Hill and breaking down fights. I understand all that. But to me, she was kind of a retired fighter for these last 4.5 years. When you think of Jessica Penne, I didn't really think of her as the fighter. I thought of her as the training partner at Alliance, as the ESPN breakdown host. I never really thought of her as a fighter. And the fact that she's going to be going in there with Lupita Godinez, here's the thing. You talk about the Vanessa Demopoulos fight. LFA themselves was promoting that as one of their fight of the years for last year. So that just tells you how good that fight was. We're not just blowing smoke at that fight. Like, it was a very, very high-level contest.
That's what I'm saying. I'm dead serious. Normally it's one side at the end we come in.
It's a bad fight for Penne.
I'm very excited to see Lupi Godinez in this fight, and I think it's a really big opportunity to almost have a coming out party. The fight against Goldie would have been a little more low risk for Penne, because again, with Goldie, it's just a lot of volume. She's a really good striker, in and out. She's kind of short for the division. And again, for Penne, not one of the bigger fighters. For Godinez, actually at a height disadvantage in this fight, which is going to happen. The reach in favor of Penne. Penne was one of those longer, kind of lankier fighters at atomweight. So it'll be interesting to see, again, what we get. Because for Penne, you're originally going to be taking on a volume striker. Now you get a power puncher. And for Godinez, really good footwork, really good movement on the feet, and a really crisp 1-2. It's always 1-2 and going forward, and a really good jab.
And one thing that we've seen from Jessica Penne is if you pressure her, she will back up. She's like Tyron Woodley after he lost the belt. You don't really have to do much to get her up against the cage. And the issue is, where does Jessica Penne get finished at? Look at the Joanna fight. Look at the Jessica Andrade fight. Those two fighters, now yes, those two fighters are far better than either ones in this division right now, but still, those two fighters were able to get Penne up against the the cage. And one thing Penne does, Anthony Smith does it too, even though I think he's a good MMA striker. I hate it when fighters get their back up against the cage, put their hands up like this, and just try to throw front kicks to keep their opponents away from them. That is not an effective technique of damaging your opponent or getting your back off the cage. That is pretty much a submissive position, saying like, hey, get away from me. And that's some place that Jessica Penne finds herself often in her fights. She can't get backed up against the cage, and against a power puncher like Godinez, I do see this fight going similar to the Andrade fight. It might not be the first round TKO like we saw in Jessica Andrade's ability to beat Penne, but it will be a, you're going to get backed up, Penne's going to have her back into the cage, and she's going to be eating shots throughout this fight.
If you look at it, I mean, Godinez almost knocked out Demopoulos in the second round to the point where she was kind of stumbling around. At the end of the round, she like had a hard time getting back to her corner. She actually did look all right. The commentary milked it a little bit. For Godinez, taking this fight on just day's notice, she opened a minus 185 favorite. It dropped. It went back up. She's now a minus 292. So it does scare me away from it because of the odds. They're a little silly. But for Penne, open a plus 155. She's now a plus 230. There is some money coming in on Penne at this point. So it'll be interesting to see where we are on Saturday with Fight Name Picks question mark kicks. But I tip my hand early. I've been this excited about a prospect in a while, and it was a pleasure to go back and watch the tape study. 903 total Tapology votes, 84% Godinez, 87% by decision. I will throw the caveat out there. This is just like Jarjus Dano and Jorgen De Castro, because for Dano,
here's the
problem. He'd been out for so long, he lost a fight, then he fought Christian Colombo to a draw, because Colombo, you know, lost a point early. It's a weird fight. I'm assuming Jessica Penne has been refreshed and rejuvenated over the time off. Do I expect the same fighter that fought Michelle Waterson to a fight of the year? No, but it should make it interesting. I think Penne's a good fighter, you know, in general, but man, Lupi Godinez is a good fighter.
Craig, you're putting out fires you don't have to put out right now. Here's the thing. Jarjus and Jorgen are heavyweights. That can happen. You can land a lucky shot. Jessica Penne can't land a lucky knockout on Godinez. She doesn't have that kind of power, and she doesn't have the submission game where, oh, it's on the mat, automatically I favor Penne to such a degree that I think she's going to submit her. I don't see her getting those Hail Mary type techniques in this fight, and I do see this being fairly one-sided for Godinez.
Great camps. Angela Hill versus Rose Namajunas, and what? Claire Guthrie. Interesting ones for Godinez. But yeah, we're both going with Godinez in this fight. It's not a Canadian thing. It's not even a Mexican thing. It's a North American thing, Matt. I'm really looking forward to this fight. It should be a great card. We have a great main event with Robert Whittaker taking on Kelvin Gastelum. Finally, in our main events, keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Big time fight, the one that I'm most looking forward to on this card. We have Wreck-It Ralph fighting the Hulk. We have Alexander Romanov fighting Juan Espino. And while the nicknames aren't what I just said, they're actually King Kong and El Guapo. I love this fight. For Romanov, this guy has the weirdest mix of backgrounds and techniques. So, let's go over it. He's out of Moldova. You don't see a lot of Moldovan fighters. Ivan Kutselaba is one that rings a bell. But if you watch him fight, the guy's just a meathead. He runs after people, he picks them up, belly-to-belly suplex, throws them, gets on top. And if you watch his last fight against Marcos Rogério de Lima, well, he puts his forearm into his neck and pushes down on it and puts him to sleep.
High level.
It's disgusting. And if you look at his opposite, Juan Espino, this guy's just a really, really interesting character. He's out of the Canary Islands over in Spain. He trains an American top team with Junior Dos Santos and Alistair Overeem. Andre Arlovski is also on this card. And for Juan Espino, very fleet of foot for a guy that's 40 years old. And for Arlovski and for Espino, both heavyweights over 40, not something you have every day. But for Espino, not as many miles on the ticker. He's really able to kind of, you know, judge his gas tank well. And if you went and watched his last fight against Jeff Hughes, totally out-wrestled him. Oh, and yeah. For Juan Espino, he kind of moves around. He gets into position. Doesn't really throw a lot of a jab. He just kind of closes distance with an overhand. It's a little bit. Like Alexei Olenek, if Olenek had way less fights. But he will kind of move around. He'll figure out his footing. He gets the takedown. And when he gets you down, it's not a question of if. It's a question of when he's going to submit you. For his submission, scarfold. It was just a bully choke. He pulled on Jeff Hughes' head and neck and gets the tap. So for Romanov, meathead, absolute meathead. For Juan Espino, a little bit more finesse in his game. For Romanov, his actual backgrounds are wrestling, Muay Thai, and not Sambo, but you'd think it, sumo. He has sumo as his background. This guy's an absolute insane ball of fun. I love the fight because if you know anything about Fight Night picks, I've been saying, Juan, where you at, for years, and now we actually get Juan Espino. I could not be more excited for this fight.
So we both have fighters who aren't ranked in a lot of divisions, really, who we both just kind of keep an eye out for. You know, it's not like I'm a fan of a lot of fighters. I just like a lot of them. So Craig, I won't say dark horse, but just this sort of like guy at heavyweight who he enjoys watching is Juan Espino. Mine's Alexander Romanov, and that's why I'm so excited for this fight, because it does feel like there's somewhat of a personalized touch to it, if you will. But I do think he broke this fight down really well. Don't really have two good strikers here, and honestly, they're both sort of awkward on the feet. When I think of Alexander Romanov, a lot of his striking is to get to the clinch, but not even. He will just kind of put his hands out and rush forward. Now, against guys, and I'm going to bring up a name who, yes, his stock might not be all that high right now, but I think this will make sense. Jarzynia Rozenstruik is a very bad fight for Alexander Romanov, because if you're a guy who's moving forward, you're not sound defensively, he can keep things very tight and on the inside and hurt you for those defensive lapses. Now, Juan Espino's striking isn't great either, so I really doubt he can capitalize on that, but it is a hole in Romanov's game that just to watch out for when he does start fighting ranked guys. But that's the thing. I think Romanov is a fighter who belongs in the rankings. Not yet. He does have to prove himself to a certain point, but he will be around for a long time. When I look at other guys in the heavyweight division, the Marcin Tybor of the world, the Blagoy Ivanovs of the world, they might not be all that exciting, but stylistically they fit in with guys like Alexander Romanov, and honestly they fit in with Juan Espino too, and that's why this fight's so entertaining. If Espino is able to take Romanov to the ground and get on top of him, it's over. I'm comfortable saying that right now. Romanov's gonna exert a crap ton of energy trying to get back up to his feet, and Juan Espino, you said he's slightly more finesse oriented, he's much more finesse oriented than Alexander Romanov, and he will be able to really float from guard, half guard, male. He's the much more, I won't say positionally aware, I'll say positionally fluid fighter in Juan Espino, where even if the bottom fighter's moving around a lot, he's similar to, and I can't believe I'm saying this, Charles Oliveira, where he can kind of float on top of a fighter. A much heavier float, if you will, a very large man, but still, it is a very efficient way of grappling from Espino, and it's the type of grappling that I'm not going to get worried if Espino's on top of Romanov round after round. I'm not going to worry about his cardio, because he is an efficient grappler. He isn't just muscling his way in and out of positions, although he can, like you had brought up with the scarf hold choke. Whereas Alexander Romanov, think of every WWE fighter ever who just throws people around. That's basically what Alexander Romanov does. It would be like if Sakuraba didn't have catch wrestling as a background, it was just the wrestler who went into MMA. But for Romanov, when he gets on top of fighters, it's not that, oh, I'm gonna pass from guard into half guard and then maybe I'll sink in a choke. He's going to get into full mount and hit you with double hammer fist from on top. Is it the best way to waste your energy? Probably not. Is it entertaining to watch? Definitely yes. But for me, I do think this fight comes down to the wrestling. And unfortunately for Juan Espino, he doesn't really have the background that's going to be able to hold up against the wrestling of Alexander Romanov. They're both going to want the fight in a very similar spot. They're both going to be looking to close the distance. But my issue comes to, once that distance is closed and these guys are really, well, belly to belly, Alexander Romanov has a ton of takedowns that he can go to in his back pocket. And they don't always involve the clinch. He can do single legs. He can do double legs. We see a lot of these high amplitude or takedowns from Romanov, but he can do much more, I'll say, nuanced takedowns, if you will, single legs, double legs. And for Espino, if he can get in top position, I like his chances. But for me, I just don't know when he's going to get the opportunity to really get the fight in that position.
Can Romanov not tire himself out? That's the question. Like, so that, if you really wanted a good pick, you wanted a sound one, if it's available as the week goes on, probably like an under two rounds, I would go with that, or under 2.5. I think that'd be a fair one. But I look at this fight, Matt, and for Romanov, you're coming in here, he had a bit of a layoff, he had some fights booked, he had a little bit of the USADA issues, he's got some big traps, he's got some really big traps. And for Juan Espino, coming out of American Top Team, you look at the picks over in the Instagrams, again, usual suspects, Arlovsky, JDS, Nikita Krylov, Alexei Olenek, Yoel Romero.
Good guys.
It's very interesting to see who he does have in, you know, in the gym and who he's getting ready with. I love the fight again. We can't pump this up enough. So if we have a look at the odds, they open at par. Romanov's now a minus 144 favorite for Juan Espino. Again, open at par. He's now a plus 118 underdog. And if we look at the Tapology votes, they're not even close. 1,015. You have 79% Romanov, 58% by knockout, 16% by submission. For the slight percentage that have Espino, 50% by submission. To me, yeah, either Romanov absolutely dominates him, or he dominates him for 2.5 minutes and gets tired and Espino submits him. That's pretty much it for me. For Romanov with the stand-up, you know, you kind of joke about it. Rogério de Lima cracked him.
Multiple times.
On his way in, and he rushes with his hands down. Somebody's going to catch him. He fights like a Sergei Pavlovich. Pavlovich is going to hit him. He fights Chris Daukaus, for heaven's sake. Maybe he finishes him. But I look at Romanov. The weird thing that he does in his fights outside of the UFC.
Somebody went Pavlovich and then Daukaus.
Keeps his hands really low. He's a southpaw. Doesn't really throw a lot of punches, but he throws a lot of front kicks, and he really closes distance that way. We've seen him against, like, Roque Martinez, and then in the last one where he did take on De Lima. It was booked once, and then he got Martinez, and then he got De Lima. I mean, he just absolutely rushed him, and he did get cracked. I don't know if Espino can, because for Espino, again, very fleet of foot, good motion, good footwork, good fundamentals, but he pretty much only has an overhand right. Did it work for Jarges? Sure it did. Old guy? Sure. But I just don't see it in this fight. I like Romanov.
I agree. I don't think Romanov is going to do to Leonardo DiCaprio what the Bear and the Revenant did, but I do see this fight being slightly similar to that. I do see Romanov's top pressure just being a lot for Juan Espino to handle. And my issue is that Juan Espino, actually off his back, is going to be looking for submissions. And that's my issue. If he was more urgent to get back up to his feet, then I might like Espino a little bit more. But the fact that he is kind of comfortable off his back, he's going to be eating damage there against a guy like Romanov. So if Romanov is able to secure those takedowns, especially early on in this fight, I do like Romanov quite a bit.
On my personal card, I'm going to go under 2.5 when the line comes up, but I'm going to pick Romanov in this fight. Yikes.
Yeah, yikes.
Both of us going with Romanov to get the win. Really love the fight. I cannot wait. Make sure you join in with Fight Night Picks ?Kicks. And hell, maybe you'll find me live on Instagram when this one's going on. I absolutely love it. We both have, like I said, Romanov to get the win over Spino. Great card. Main event. Bobby Knuckles taking on Kelvin Gastelum. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Neat fight coming up at flyweight. We have Tracy Cortez taking on Justine Kish. For Tracy Cortez, fought her entire pro career up until her last two at 125 pounds, and that was to get into the UFC. She beat Maria Agapova. Before that, she beat Erin Blanchfield with LFA. You can argue with me. I still think Blanchfield won the fight, but regardless, it's a W on your record. And listen, Blanchfield had to take the long road to get here. For Cortez, the win over Agapova, then the two fights at bantamweight, interesting, because she beat Vanessa Mello in, I'd say, impressive fashion, but everybody beat Vanessa Mello in impressive fashion. And then if you look at her last time out, she fought Stephanie Egger, and that's where it gets weird, because for Stephanie Egger, black belt in judo, ADCC trial winner, she also had a win over King Reyna, and she had a fight against a really tough out in Mara Romero Barella and finished her. So for Stephanie Egger, she had that quality about her, and she was coming in on relatively short notice. Tracy Cortez took her down and absolutely dominated her, so that impressed me a lot. But I guess for Cortez, apparently the future is at 25, so I'll be interested to see again. Weight wasn't really an issue before. Is it an issue in this one? She's had a lot of time off between the Egger fight and now. And for Justine Kish, well, she fought at 115 before, and she fights at 125 now. And for her, it's just a tale of odd fights, because you know her for striking, but then in some fights she grapples, and sometimes her submissions are there, but sometimes they're absolutely gone out the window. She's such a fighter that I just can't get a read on. Honest to goodness, I know I did, and you can go back and find the tape. I picked Kish to beat Mazo, and right up before she gets submitted, it was a halfway competitive fight. It was.
She got dropped by like 4 head kicks.
Yeah, you got to watch out for the head kicks with Sabina Mazo, because they're going to be spammed. But Kish did a decent job before. She gets head kicks. She gets finished. But for Kish, it's like she looks great. The Pudzalova fight takes her down. Absolutely dominates her on the ground. And then she fights Felice Herrig. And Herrig absolutely dominates her on the ground. For 2/3 of that entire fight, Felice Herrig was on top, controlling it.
So this fight for me, I think you can break it down and really oversimplify this fight to a certain degree. You have Tracy Cortez, who in her last fight fought Stephanie Eggers, a very big 135er and a very credentialed grappler, or at least that's what her background is. Tracy Cortez out-muscled the much bigger fighter in that fight. Now you have Justine Kish, who was moving up from 115, and honestly, her frame does match 115 a lot better than it does 125, because at 125, you're going to be facing fighters like Tracy Cortez, who physically are much bigger than you, are much better at wrestling, and I know we talk about the grappling of Justine Kish, but she's a good example of a fighter who, when in top position, she can be effective. She has decent ground and pound, she has decent top pressure, she can get bucked off if you do have a really physically strong fighter on the bottom, but anybody can. when she's on her back, though, she does just kind of fish for submissions and not work to get back up to her feet. And one thing that really bothers me with Kish, she likes to work with a closed guard on her back, but she doesn't go for a lot of submissions with it. And a closed guard, when you're fighting someone like Tracy Cortez, Cortez can be more than happy to just sit in your guard, hit you enough so that the ref doesn't stand the fight up, and really just keep the fight in that position. Now, I know a lot of you are probably thinking, well, hey, isn't that exactly how the Stephanie Eggers fight went? Yeah, it's exactly how it went, and that was against a much bigger fighter. Now, Eggers didn't really have the striking background that Kish does, but Kish doesn't have big power by any means, so I don't really think Justine Kish is as simple as, oh, if she can keep this fight on the feet, she might be able to hurt Cortez. We've seen Cortez hurt in her UFC career. We've seen her hurt on multiple occasions, really, because her striking isn't that great, and she is sort of stiff on the feet, if you will. She throws with a lot of power when she does let her hands go, but I'll compare her striking at least somewhat to Macy Barber. I do think Barber has better fluidity in her strikes, but the fact that Cortez does really like to go out there and just not overhand her way into the clinch, but it's just a lot of volume really hard, and then I'm going to go for the takedown. Someone like Kish can be overwhelmed by that initial volume, be forced to bring her hands up, and that's going to open up the takedown consistently throughout this fight. So I know I've kind of set this fight up as very heavily Tracy Cortez, but personally, I just don't know what tools Justine Kish has to really force this into a Justine Kish fight, which is very movement heavy. A lot of jabs, a lot of kicks, a lot of those things really do just play into the hand of Tracy Cortez. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on this
for
one.
For Justine Kish, very Muay Thai heavy. That is her background, of course, and she does throw a very high volume. For Tracy Cortez, it's takedown after takedown after takedown. And if you look at it so far from Dana White's Contender Series into the UFC, she got 4 in Contender Series. She got 2 in her debut against Melo, she got 3 against Egger, and I don't know where you got the S from if you're going for a higher Scrabble score than I was, but that's absolutely fine. But I look at it in this fight, if the weight cut's not a huge issue, and I feel like over at Fight Ready, they're getting her ready for a fight like this with the Santino DeFrancos of the world, I threw it down as far as the people that she's been training with or the people that have been in the pictures recently at the gym. You can kind of connect the dots a little bit, and I wrote it down, Victoria Anthony and Michaela Beck. And I had to look into their backgrounds. Very, very, very high-level wrestlers to the Olympic caliber. So if Tracy Cortez at least is, like, in proximity of a wrestler like that, I do like that. I think Santino DeFranco and the crew have really schooled her well for a good run in the UFC. To me, this feels like a setup fight. It honestly does. And an opportunity where, hey, we're not going to give you a big name or a big rank fighter. You're not going to fight, yikes, Miranda Maverick or Macy Barber, who are fighting themselves. That makes sense. But you get Justine Kish in this one. And for Kish, it's tricky. I mean, she's 2-3 in her last 5. She's training out of Black House. She actually does have a really good training partner that can somewhat emulate what you're going to get out of Cortez, and somebody who we've already brought up in this series, Vanessa Demopoulos, is a main training partner of Kish. So you do like that coming into this one. So maybe if Kish, if she can kind of keep Cortez away and she can mix her striking in, there's an opportunity. But I look at this one, Matt, and on Saturday on Question Mark Kicks, you're going to have to tune back in to check it out. I'm more than likely going to have Tracy Cortez as one half of it. She opened a -235 favorite. She's a -263 right now. And for Justine Kish, she opened a +200. It did drop. I mean, she got, you could have had her at a +170. I mean, yes. And now she's a +210. And if you have a look at the Tapology votes, they're knocking my socks off. Didn't see this before. 993 of them, 95% Cortez, 89% decision. That's the fun part for us because we don't check Tapology until after we hit record. But yeah, I really do like Cortez in this one. I feel like it's a tailor-made matchup. And again, that's going to be one half of the Question Mark Kicks parlay, unless the line gets stupid as the week goes on. But I do like Cortez.
No, I couldn't agree more. For Kish, she basically has to keep Cortez off her for a full 15 minutes. And yeah, she might be able to do that for 1 minute, 2 minutes, maybe even 3. But just as that pressure continues, I do see Kish eventually folding, probably getting taken down multiple times throughout this fight. So yeah, I agree. I like Tracy Cortez.
Both of us going with Fight Ready in Arizona's Tracy Cortez to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. Our co-main event, Dracar Close taking on Jeremy Lil Heathen Stevens. And in our main event, we have Bobby Knuckles taking on the man himself, Kelvin Gastelum. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time banger at featherweight, Matt. We have Ricardo Ramos taking on Bill Senor Perfecto Algio. And listen, there's not a lot of people from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Anyway, I did the research for Bill Algio's last fight, and I talked all about it. So I'm done with that. What I will focus on is the fact that for Bill Algio, it was strength of schedule coming into the UFC. And yeah, the guy's got 5 losses to 14 wins. But you look at the last 2, and hey, Brendan Lochnane on Contender Series, that's going to happen. Everyone and their dog thought that Brendan Lochner deserved a UFC contract, and Dana White said no. I'm like, Roger Goodell, I don't want to have fun. Not signing him. PFL, fill your boots. So, for the man himself, Algio, he goes back to CFFC, beats Tim Dueling, recognizable regional name, and then he gets the call to fight Ricardo Lamas. And in that fight, it's a loss. It's a decision loss. And if you only watch the third round, Lamas went off. But in the first two rounds, it was closer than that. And Bill Algio actually, you know, put in good work. I was really impressed with him. So in his next time out, did I pick Bill Algio to beat Spike Carlisle? Honestly, I can't remember at this point. I'd be honest if I could. I can't remember. But he sent Spike Carlisle packing to LFA, and he absolutely owned. So for Bill Algio, what do you know? This guy's baseline good at everything. He's a decent striker. He has decent cardio, except for in the Lamas fight. But they went back and forth like crazy.
Also, Lamas, one of the best featherweights of all time who's never got a belt. So if you lose to him on very short notice, that's no big deal.
He can really do just about everything quite well for Bill Algio. For Ricardo Ramos, I have zero idea what this guy's baseline is. Because on one day, honest to goodness, I think he's a top 10 UFC featherweight. I'm not lying. He's only 25 years old. He's out of Brazil. He trains at Team Alpha Male. You look at the corner. Raymond Daniels is training with him. You got Alex Munoz that's on this card. So with Daniels, excellent striking coach. With Alex Munoz, excellent wrestling coaching. You're really going to get all of those things. With Ricardo Ramos, rather, he's a guy that came in on Dana White's Looking for a Fight, Bangor, Maine edition. Been there and done that with NEF, but you look at that fight, and you look at what he's been able to do in the UFC, and it's kind of a mixed bag, because on his best day, he's beating Ayman Zahabi, and he's looking amazing. Double spins, finishes him, looks great. And then you look at the losses. I mean, Lerone Murphy, I think he's a great fighter. I really do like Lerone Murphy, but Murphy was able to dismantle him, and when he had Ramos hurt, he turtled up like he was totally done. His grappling's good. He's a good jiu-jitsu practitioner, but his wrestling's weird. It's not great offensively, but it's good defensively. He can get really tired. And that's another thing. For a young guy to get tired like that, I worry about it. But again, when Ricardo Ramos is on, in my mind's eye, he's a good, good fighter, and he has a very high potential. So for me, it's almost like Ramos has a very high ceiling. For Bill Algio, he's never going to win the featherweight title. I don't think he is. I'm sure Bill does. I'm sure his gym even thinks it. Everybody around him thinks it. So I'm not saying that to, you know, poo-poo Bill Algio. To me, Ramos has a very high ceiling. He's a much younger fighter. But this is a weird one.
You did with Ricardo Ramos what I did with Jonathan Martinez. So I'm just going to tell you now. He's never going to be in the top 10 of the featherweight division or the bantamweight division. He can have good fights with some guys, but here's the problem with Ricardo Ramos. And I think we're sort of, I don't know if we're the victims or if we're the people putting it out. He doesn't have that much knockout power. Yeah, the knockout against Ayman Zahabi was great, but I do think Ramos is one of those guys who, he's a victim to his own highlight reel, if that makes any sense whatsoever. When I think of Ricardo Ramos, of course the first thing I think of is that double spinning elbow against Ayman Zahabi, but that's what I fixate on, and I look away from the fact that, well, he doesn't deal with pressure all that well. He has good striking technique, but that's really the problem. He doesn't have enough pop to put guys down with his striking, but he doesn't have the cardio to really overwhelm guys with his volume, and for Ramos, you about the wrestling, for me, if he just had cardio, he'd be that much better of a fighter, because if he could match his output with his jiu-jitsu credentials, I do think we'd have a very dangerous fighter here. Could you imagine if Ricardo Ramos could go out there, throw a lot of volume against the cage to a guy, make them sort of cover up, and then take them down? You're dealing with a very dangerous fighter. My problem is, Ramos is a guy who will just throw single shots, and a lot of his single shots, they do look nice. He has a nice spinning back kick to the body, for instance. It looks kind of Max Holloway-ish when you look at it by itself, but my problem is there's nothing that comes after that spinning back kick to the body. He will just kind of stand there and look at his opponent in the mirror, and one thing Algio is really good at, even just go back to the Lamas fight, and he lost that fight. When Lamas would stand there at range and try to make reads on Algio, Algio's rangy and awkward for this division. And he can throw really weird techniques. And he's a guy who, he lifts his leg before he throws the kick. I know that's a very weird thing, but I wanted to make sure I talked about this for Robert Whittaker, so I feel like I have to for Algio. He doesn't throw kicks in a traditional sense where he brings his whole leg up at once. He'll bring his knee up, and then he flicks out his leg at the end. It's interesting because the kick won't have as much power behind it, but you're going to find openings in your opponent's defense a lot better when you throw kicks that way. And that's something Algio is actually really good at doing. So for Ricardo Ramos, I just don't know how he's going to get this floor to the mat. And even if he does get the fight to the mat, mat. I don't think it's a cakewalk for him. And Algio, I agree with you. I don't think he is going to have the featherweight strap at any point. I don't think he's going to be a top five guy. But I do think he's going to offer a very hard fight and a very fun fight for anybody outside of the top five. I really do think that. If Algio, I can see him being one of those names where, oh, a top five featherweight matchup falls out. They just throw his name in there. Will he beat the guy who he's matched up with? No, but I can see that being a fight of the night type of fight. So for Algio, I just see him having the higher ceiling out of these two.
For me, if you look at Hamos, the perfect kind of comparison fight that he's already had, the split decision win over Kyung Ho Gong, and he's a very, very good grappler. He can really wrestle quite well. You want to watch an exciting fighter that you don't hear enough about? Kyung Ho Gong is that fighter. If Hamos fights like that, maybe he could beat Bill Algio. For Bill Algio, you just got to wear on him. You just got to close that distance, create that gap. And for Hamos, I think of him more as a distance striker. Again, with Zahabi, it was in tight with those elbows. It was behind the black lines. He was able to do it. But for the most part, it's a lot of long, rangy attacks. And if you can pressure him, you can beat him. So if we have a look at the odds on this one, Matt, they are relatively close. Let's look at Algio first. He opened a minus 110. He's a minus 122 right now. For Hamos, he opened a minus 110. He's now a minus 102. So the money has come in on Algio as the week's gone on. Tapology votes, honestly can't wait to see them. 970 of them, 65% with Hamos, 81% by decision. The fans have Hamos. The people that are putting money on it have Algio. Is it King of Prussia or is it Brazil?
Other X factor, Algio's so much bigger than Hamos, it's not even funny. Like, I get it, Hamos, he's a long, rangy guy. He's bigger than what you would kind of imagine a bantamweight moving up to featherweight would be in your mind. Algio's gonna dwarf him in that cage. So we're dealing with a guy who can fight with pressure, has decent power on his shots. I'm not saying Algio's like a Calvin Cater or anything could really put you down, but if he can get his combinations together, he can definitely hurt you on the feet. He's the bigger guy, he's decent takedown defense, and he's well-rounded. Those are all things that will kind of wear on Hamos as this fight goes on, and maybe the cardio of Hamos is a little bit better up at featherweight. I do think that weight cut was really hard on him, and that did play into why he looked so drained in some of those fights. But for me, I like Bill Algio a lot in this fight, and I am very surprised with these Tapology votes there.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it for Hamos, and I mean, you look at the losses. All right, so you got Lerone Murphy, you got Syed Nurmagomedov. Listen, that's going to happen. Both very good fighters. And I like the fact that he's been training with Guilherme Faria over at Team Alpha Male. Very, very credentialed Muay Thai coach and Muay Thai practitioner. All great stuff for Hamos. If you're training a Team Alpha Male, there's a reason why you're there. You want to shore up your wrestling. You want to work in your jiu-jitsu with people like The Damage, but also Munoz is on this card. All great stuff. I still like Algio. The size advantage, the pressure. There's a lot of reasons why I think he's going to be able to get the win here.
No, I couldn't agree more. I like Algio a lot. And again, I'm not saying he's going to be a guy with a number next to his name, but I could see Algio as one of those guys like a borderline 15, 14, could sneak into the rankings, could sneak out on his best day or worst. So I like Algio in this one, I do.
So really, that's probably a fade because, I mean, he could end up like Jonathan Martinez, but that's
true, honestly.
I do like Algio. We're both going with Bill Algio to get the win. Love the fight. And we're getting into the thick of our main card. We have an awesome co-main event. Okay. Jeremy Stephens taking on Jakar Close in our main event. Robert Whittaker taking on Kelvin Gastelum. Finally, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. If you were walking through an airport and you're kind of like looking around, you're trying to find your terminal and you go, hey, is that Michael Chandler? And the guy goes, no, but I fight in the UFC. My name's Alexander Munoz. We have Alexander Munoz, Michael Chandler Light, taking on Luis Violent Bob Ross Pena. And that's where the Michael Chandler comparisons stop. Both guys are good wrestlers and they look like carbon copies of each other. And they're both lightweights, except one of them's way on the other side of the country. He's a wrestling coach at Team Alpha Male. The other one's going to fight for the vacant UFC lightweight belt coming up shortly. And for Alexander Munoz, it's an interesting career that he's had because he's a guy that not a lot of people want to sign up to fight. And that's pretty much all I've read about him, is nobody wanted to take a fight against Alexander Munoz, especially after he beat Nick Newell on Dana White's Contender Series. And for Munoz, he assumed he was going to get a contract after beating a big name like that. For Newell, hasn't really been the best of career from, well, really, Contender Series on. But for Munoz, it was interesting. So he fights after that on Dana White's Looking for a Fight. He fights Troy Lamson. Recognizable name. He wins. That episode was familiar, or it might jog your memory, because Dana White stood on top of a cliff and didn't want to jump into the ocean. And that's pretty much all I can tell you about that. So Munoz wins that fight. Gets an opportunity in the UFC. He fights Nazareth Hackpress on short notice. And he did not look all that great. He did get an early takedown against Hackpress in the first round. And that was pretty much it. He got his ears boxed in. Now he's going to be taking on Violent Bob Ross, Luis Pena, a guy that's had fights booked and then fall out. Namely, he was supposed to fight the man himself, Jakar Close, in this weekend's co-main event. Close gets Stevens in a co-main, big name, and Pena draws Munoz. What a weird ride it's been for Luis Pena. Not to mention his entire UFC career, camp changes, and everything after The Ultimate Fighter. And during The Ultimate Fighter.
The career path of Luis Pena has been a really odd one, and I'll be completely honest. I jumped onto the hype of Violent Bob Ross. I thought he was the best fighter in his season of The Ultimate Fighter. And I thought going into the Mike Trezano fight, I was like, oh, he's going to beat him, he'll submit him off of his back, and he's going to go on and do great things. Turns out wrestling is a big old Achilles heel of Luis Pena, and not just the wrestling. This is my problem with Luis Pena. He's a great striker at range. He has good defensive submissions. He's not good at that weird mid to close range fighting. And I shouldn't even say close range, because honestly, his clinch game is pretty good. He's got good elbows. He's a good fighter who does understand, okay, I have long arms. Fighter's going to want to get close to me. I'm going to have to throw elbows if they do. Brian Ortega was the first guy who really opened my mind to this. I know it's weird, but like, three-pointers in the NBA in 2012, it just kind of clicked. When Brian Ortega was like, yeah, I'm a big guy for featherweight, so the reason I hit Frank Yeager with an elbow is, well, Frank Yeager's a lot shorter than me. He's going to have close the distance. I figured that'd be the best way to do it. And just like that, a big old light shone. And I was like, hey, that's really smart for long-range you guys to do. Luis Pena does understand that, but my problem with Pena is, it's weird. His best takedown defense almost are his elbows and knees. It's almost his way of just making his opponent not want to shoot in the first place. Because we talked about defensive submissions. The defensive striking of Luis Pena isn't bad. He is good at making his opponents pay for their takedown attempts, especially against his back up against the cage. We talked about Travis Brown elbows, talked about knees. Pena's good at all those things. But my issue with a lot of those techniques is he's putting so much of his focus into the elbows and not into the takedown defense itself. And that's when he finds himself into trouble. Guys can either A, crack him because they fake the takedown defense, force his hands to go down low, and then they come up top with a punch. Or if you just chain wrestle him over and over and over again, you can make him tired. And Violent Bob Ross, yeah, he used to fight at featherweight. I don't know how he ever made that weight cut, first of all. I couldn't imagine. I think he's, what, 6'3", weighing in at 145 pounds. Absurd to me. It's wild to me he even weighs lightweight, to be completely honest, but still, just the fact that he cut another 10 pounds off his body. But this fight, to me, is just a skill check for Luis Pena. Can he defend takedowns and force it to become a striking battle? Because if he tries to play off his back and get a submission on Alex Munoz, he's not going to be able to. Munoz is way too good on top, and he's too smart of a grappler to get caught by something. I won't say amateurish, but you get the idea. He won't get caught by a submission from a guy of his back unless he's fighting a Brian Ortega or a Charles Oliveira, let's say. I think Munoz is that good of a wrestler. And for Munoz, all he really does is wrestle. He can strike. He's not the worst striker in the world. He does have decent boxing. But when I think of Alex Munoz, I think of the perfect archetype of what comes out of Team Alpha Male. He boxes and he wrestles. The difference is a lot of those fighters, they do have other wrinkles in their game. Look at Uriah Faber. He does those two things exceedingly well, but he's also very good once the fight hits the mat. For Munoz, you will get a little bit of that Jake Shields-ish out of him if he does get that top position. He's really heavy on top. He can go from, you know, he can pass your guard, of course, but he will go for position over submission a lot of the time. And for Luis Pena, we talked about the Luis Smolka effect, but Pena is a fighter who is very comfortable off of his back to the point where it isn't always a benefit for him. He does have good elbows off his back, kind of similar to GSP when he fought Michael Bisping, or I guess the other way around, Bisping when he lost to GSP. But Pena, my problem with Pena is there's signs in all of his fights that he can be a really big star. He will show like a 30-second stretch where you're like, wow, Luis Pena, if he could just evolve that one area of his game, he could turn into a really exciting contender. But fight in and fight out, we don't really see this new version of Luis Pena. He's not a fighter who I think, wow, we really saw him improve a lot since his time on The Ultimate Fighter. So personally, I still look at him as the same fighter as the guy who was on The Ultimate Fighter. And to me, I think this matchup is much more suited towards his skill level than the original matchup with Jakar Close would have been.
100%. And the interesting thing about Luis Pena, if you go on the socials and you have a look, he's out of ATT, and he's been there for a little bit now. There's some pictures with Masvidal and some of the big guys there, but you can see that he's been working with Anderson Franca quite a bit. And I thought, okay, well, I know him. He was in the corner of Mateusz Gamrot last weekend, and holy friggin' smokes. If you weren't on the train, you can get on right now. That was amazing. But for Pena, I like that. You're training with a guy like Gamrot. It's going to give you a lot of wrestling looks, and you're going to be able to drill a lot of the things that could cause you problems with a guy like Alexander Munoz. And again, like, I focus on this. He also had the pictures with Kyle Dake. I don't know how much they wrestled, but that guy is Well, the best wrestler. The best wrestler. So we'll see how it goes for Peña. With Munoz, same cast of characters. We talked about it with Team Alpha Male. Raymond Daniels, Ricardo Ramos is on this card as well. A lot of seasoned veterans that he's been with for a very long time, being the wrestling coach at that gym. But very much a wrestler. And you see it. He's got the boxing gloves on. And he does strike. You have to. But he's not a striker. I mean, Nazareth Hackpress is probably the most technical boxer that you're going to find in this division, or if not the one of the best boxers that you're going to find in this division. And again, once Hackpress defended a few takedowns, boom goes the dynamite. I mean, Munoz had no answer. So can Peña defend the takedowns? He's at a low percentage. More than half of the takedowns against him are successful. And listen, Matt Frivola, kind of a similar fighter to Munoz. Peña lose that one by split decision. We're splitting hairs as to whether or not Peña won or Frivola won.
Close fight.
After that, he beat Steve Garcia. Beat him handily on the ground. Really did a good job of dominating him on the ground. That was a year ago. And then he gets submitted by Kama Worthy. Kama doesn't have a chin. And sometimes Kama knocks people out. And sometimes he submits them. And on that night, he submitted Violent Bob Ross. So it is a really interesting fight. In terms of the odds in this one, Peña is the favorite. He opened a minus 175. He's now a minus 145. For Munoz, he opened a plus 150. He's now plus 122. And the Tapology votes, and I can't wait, 1,014, and 76% have Peña, 77% by decision. So the hardcores are going Peña. The odds have Peña. Matt, are you going Peña?
I just know this is going to be a really one-sided fight, and it's going to be one-way traffic. I just don't really know which way the sign's going to be pointing, because I can see a very likely scenario where Alex Munoz goes out there and really only secures three takedowns. One at the start of the first, the start of the second, and the start of the third, and completely out-grapples and dominates Peña on the mat. I can realistically see that happening. I can see another world where Peña lands one uppercut while Munoz tries to come in for a takedown, and then Munoz is really tentative on the outside the whole entire fight, and Peña picks him apart. I'm going to ever so slightly pick Luis Peña in this fight, because he has more, he's the more well-rounded out of the two. If the fight is on the feet, well, of course they're going to pick Peña. If it's on the mat, I favor Munoz to win rounds, but I don't really see him doing the overall damage or threatening with a lot of submissions on the mat. Whereas if Peña can get on top somehow, well, he can damage Munoz quite a bit from that top position, a lot of elbows. And then his submission game, although not great, it is very nifty. And for a guy who is that tall and rangy at that weight class, you can get submissions in weird positions. He can get darce chokes, a lot of head and arm positions that just physically Alex Munoz won't be able to get into just because of his build. So I am ever so slightly going to pick Luis Peña, but I can see a very likely scenario where Alex Munoz goes out there and just absolutely ragdolls Peña on the mat.
I mean, I don't think people in the year 2021 use the word nifty very often, but pretty nifty submissions. For me, Luis Peña's fought lower level guys and beaten lower level guys. How low level is Alexander Munoz? That's really the question. Yeah, because if you look at the five on in, Ocho Peterson, you beat him by decision. Cool.
Kill Matt Wyman.
You beat Matt Wyman. Cool. You beat Steve Garcia on short notice. Cool.
Awesome.
Matt Frivola beat you. And then you look at the last loss, Kama Worthy beat you. Luis Peña has been baseline 30 to 35 in the division. Maybe, if you're nice.
I don't know how many fighters there are in lightweight.
If you're nice, I like Alex Munoz in this one. I do not like that takedown defense. Can you improve it at ATT? 100%. Why not at AKA where he was before? It's just, it
well,
is.
Well, there's not a lot of guys his size training at AKA.
Yeah, it's not like the former champion was there.
He's not there now. That's my problem. For Luis Peña, I love the move to ATT because you look at what Luis Peña already does well. What ATT does well is they turn strikers into strikers who can also defend takedowns. Like, look at the main people at ATT. Amanda Nunes, Jorge Masvidal, Dustin Poirier. Like, those are all amazing stand-up fighters who have the grappling defense as well. So I do like the move from Peña. Again, this fight's going to be one-sided. It really just depends on which side you think is going to win.
I totally agree. It's either Peña probably finishes Munoz or Munoz grinds out a decision. I'm going to go with the grind out of a decision. I'm going with Munoz. You're going with Luis Peña. I'm really interested to see what people are thinking about this fight because it's probably going to be one of the two. Oh, yeah. Let us know down below in the comments section. Great card coming up. Big time co-main event. Bet Luis Peña's. Wishes he shined that bet sheet or that bout sheet against Jeremy Stephens. You have Jakara Close taking on Stephens. And in the main event, you have Gastelum taking on Whitaker. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Somebody's going to get finished at middleweight this weekend, and it could be Robert Whittaker, and it could be Kelvin Gastelum, but it's most likely going to be either Abdul Razak Al-Hassan or Jacob Malkoon. And for Jacob Malkoon, They made you pay for his last fight. How ridiculous is that? They put him in there, he fought Phil Haas, you knew he was gonna get finished, and Phil Haas knocked him the fuck out. And it wasn't even close. And it was stupid that they even made that fight. The guy was 4-0 fighting Phil Haas that had all the hype in the world at one point. He was on the Ultimate Fighter. He was with the World Series. He was on Dana White's Contender Series. He had all the hype. And he absolutely stole it from Mal Kuhn. And for Mal Kuhn, he was that guy. He was just that guy, you know. Well, nobody wants to ever fight him because of who his main training partner is. And listen, if you look at the gyms and whatnot, out of Gracie Grange, if you want to call it that, you have Mal Kuhn, you have Robert Whittaker. They're buddies. They're in the same weight class. They're primary training partners. The only thing is, for every great fighter, there's that primary training partner. And my perfect example, and I'll take it, well, there's the Diaz brothers, and then there's Chris Avila. And one of our most watched Bellator videos ever was Anthony Pretty Boy Taylor and Chris Avila, and people got so riled up that we called out Chris Avila, but look at his damn record. The guy's 6-7 now. Chris Avila, not a Diaz brother. There's so many other training partners out there like that. Jacob Malcoon's 4-0. You look at the wins, because 5 on in, well, there's only 4 fights. He beats Cam Rouston, 4 years ago? He beats Ryan Hakeda, 5-4, knocks him out.
I won't forget
He beats Christoph Van Dijk. That's a good win. That actually is a really good win. And then he beats Sebastian Tamezi by decision a year and a half ago, and then he gets a fight against Phil Haas. I will say this, from all the tape study out of Jacob Mal Kuhn, there's things that I like. Can he incorporate all of the skills of MMA? Sure. But there's a reason why I said somebody's going to get finished in this fight. Jacob Mal Kuhn could definitely finish Abdulrazak Al-Hassan. We saw it from the long layoff due to extenuating circumstances, and we'll just go with that and run with it. MMA media, don't want to go too far, but with Abdulrazak Al-Hassan, this guy looked like an absolute world beater. Like, he was riding high at 70. He had the crazy fights against Sabah Homasi. I get to be at one of them. He had that crazy win over Nico Price, and it was like, man, the sky's the limit for Judo Thunder. Long layoff, comes back and fights Munir Lazez. Weight-wise, not great. Still a big guy. Weight-wise, not great. Goes in there and absolutely throws down on Munir Lazez, and was like, hey, this fight's going to be over soon. And then it wasn't. Lazez persevered, and Lazez looked great, and Abdulrazak Al-Hassan tired after what? The later stages of the first round.
It was fast.
And then he comes back out and he fights, I'd say, a really tough out. He fights Chaos Williams, the Ox fighter. And for Chaos Williams, had the great win over Alex Morono, goes in there against Abdulrazak Al-Hassan, starches him with a right cross and knocks him out cold. The weight cut was definitely an issue for Al-Hassan. I mean, the guy's 35. He's almost 36 at this point. So now he moves up to middleweight. And if you thought he was thick before, he's going to be thick at middleweight. The other thing here, height-wise, Abdulrazak Al-Hassan was a big guy for 70. Jacob Mal Kuhn's not a big guy for 85. Like, frame-wise, not a huge guy. So this fight, it's whoever finishes the other guy. It's as plain and simple as that. Abdulrazak Al-Hassan's a power puncher. Jacob Mal Kuhn's the guy that trains with Robert Whittaker. And again, try to be a nice guy, try to be objective, done the research, yikes.
So I'll add a couple of things. Now, I do like what you had said. Mal Kuhn is a smaller middleweight. So initially when this fight was first booked, I was like, oh, at middleweight, that's weird. I guess Razak Al-Hassan has had problems with his weight at 170. But yeah, physically, Abdulrazak Al-Hassan is going to be a big 185er. Now, is he going to match up with, like, I guess a Yoel Romero or even a Darren Till? Maybe not. But still, those fighters are still exceptions as well. They're big even for middleweights. For Jacob Mal Kuhn, I could honestly see a move to 170 in his future at some point, just because physically, he isn't that big guy. And it's weird for Mal Kuhn, too. I think he could finish Al-Hassan, but I do think the weight did play a part in Al-Hassan's chin, at least in his last fight. And hey, you're gonna get knocked out against Chaos Williams if you eat a clean shot. Now, that was one of those knockouts where you're genuinely concerned for the person who got knocked out because it was just so vicious. And that's kind of the taste that's been left in my mouth, if you will, because the last two performances from Al-Hassan, they haven't been very good. Now, he looked good in the initial round, I guess, against Lazez, like you had mentioned, really explosive with his shots. And when he lands, guys feel it. Even go back to the Nico Price fight. Like, Nico Price goes in there with power punchers. He's fought Vicente Luque twice. Now, he got finished in both of those fights, but still, Price is a durable fighter who is normally, he can give anybody a hard 15 minutes. That's what I say Nico Price can do. He's going to give you a hard 15. And Abdulrazak Al-Hassan just destroyed him, threw one flurry and knocked him out. I could see this being similar to that fight where Malkoon, he is sort of stationary. I do like his grappling a little bit more than Al Hassan's in this fight, but he doesn't have the best footwork. Like you mentioned with Juan Espino. Juan Espino wants to get the fight to the mat, but at least he is fleet of foot on the feet. So he's not going to be all that hittable before he gets the opportunity to get the fight to the mat. Whereas Malkoon, he will kind of plant. Now, if he does throw with power and catches Al Hassan in the chin, maybe he can put him away. Because when Al Hassan does let his hands go, he does leave his chin so high up in the air, it's not even funny. So yeah, I couldn't agree more. This fight, probably not going to go the distance. Of course, I just said that, so it's probably going to be the worst fight ever for 15 minutes. But I'm going to say Al Hassan. I don't know if by TKO, maybe I'll just say it. Because from what I've seen out of Jacob Malkoon, I do agree. It sucks that he is kind of in this position as you're just Robert Whittaker's training partner. Like, Zaza Pachulia's Klay Thompson's rebounder now that Klay Thompson's back in the gym getting shots up. But you don't see a lot of people on Twitter saying, hey, why aren't teams signing Zaza Pachulia? It's just because there's no real place for him right now. Same as for Malkoon, I get it. You're the training partner, and I'm sure he helps Robert Whittaker a lot. And I'm sure Robert Whittaker's probably his number one fan. I'm sure Whittaker's a big reason as to why Malkoon's in the UFC at this point. But at this point, yeah, other than just being that primary training partner, I don't really know what the long-term future of Malkoon is, especially in this division. So I'm going to ever so slightly pick Al Hassan, but this fight could go so many different ways.
This is one, again, leave it off your card. It's just like the old Georges Dano and Jorgen De Castro. We put the disclaimer out there. Leave it off your card because the odds are silly. And for Abdulrazak Al Hassan, he's a big favorite in this fight. He opened a minus 350. He's a minus 302 or thereabouts on best fight odds with the average. For Malkoon, opened a plus 285. He's now a plus 238. For anybody that says that they have a lock for this one, if it's not Manpreet, like, just put Manpreet aside because he's great and that's his thing. But if you're like, man, Jacob Malkoon's a lock, yeah, come on. 90% of 993 votes in Tapology have Al Hassan to win, 86% by knockout. For Malkoon, 46% by knockout out of the 10% that have him. I think Al Hassan's going to be able to get it done. The other thing, too, Abdulrazak Al Hassan, if he invests in the kicks, they are thunderous.
And he's fat. Like, the
and he has a judo background, too. Like, there's a lot of things for Al Hassan. We just have to see how it translates at 185. So this is another opportunity here. He had one, lost the long time off, lost to Lizez. He had another one against Chaos Williams, relative unknown still. And now you have Jacob Malkoon. And for Jacob Malkoon, I mean, goodness gracious. For him and for his sake, I hope that he wins this fight. Because for Robert Whittaker, too, to see your guy lose, and maybe lose impressively twice, on the same card that you're on, at least this is free TV, you don't have to pay for the damn pay-per-view, but it's a tough one.
It is a tough one. Again, I like Al Hassan ever so slightly, but this fight is just hard to predict because there's so many unknowns for both fighters.
Both of us going with Fortis MMA's Abdulrazak Al Hassan to get the win. Really looking forward to the fight. I love our next one. Chase Sherman taking on Andre Arlovsky. Big one at heavyweight. Our second over 40-year-old on the card at heavyweight. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. Short notice booking at heavyweight as we have the Vanilla Gorilla Chase Sherman taking on the Pitbull Andre Arlovsky. And originally, it was supposed to be Sherman against one Parker Porter. Porter out of the fight. In steps American Top Team's former UFC heavyweight champion Andre the Pitbull Arlovsky. 3-2 in his last five. He did lose his last fight against Tom Aspinall, current ranked heavyweight. And for Arlovsky, he's been in and out of the rankings here recently, and he's faced some really good competition. The other loss that's on his record is the Arizino Rosenstrike. I mean, a top five talent at that. And for Chase Sherman, listen, he got booted out of the UFC. He lost against Augusto Sakai in impressive fashion, I'll say. And then he went down to Island Fights. And he really kind of changed his game ever so slightly, where he fine-tuned the fact that, yes, do I move forward? 100%. He throws long looping shots with a lot of power on the end of them. His main real asset, I would say, is his boxing for sure. We've seen that. He will throw the occasional leg kick. I think that's going to be a big difference maker in this fight because both these guys throw leg kicks. One of them checks them, but they both throw good leg kicks. And for Chase Sherman, really implements a lot of heavy pressure and always pushes forward against his opponents. And if you watch his return to the UFC, little fanfare. I mean, this guy was the GIF King over on Twitter. There was Chase Sherman, GIF King. There was Elias Theodoru, GIF King. One guy's not in the UFC anymore, and the other guy doesn't post GIFs. So it's pretty weird how that changed. But for Chase Sherman, one big X factor in this, you can see it on different websites. He's out of American Top Team in D'Iberville, Mississippi. He's out of Jackson Wink previously. He's actually training for this fight camp out of a really, really good gym an Elevation fight team. And a lot of people might not know that. You got to go into the deep cuts. You got to watch some of the interviews out there. But he's had a few of them where he's talked about it. And Alistair Overeem was one of the really big reasons why they got in contact and Overeem wanted him there. So he went. And you think of the level of training partners, the Overeems and the Blades of the world, the Trevor Whitmans. He's training his striking with P4P or Pound for Pound Fitness's own big time striking coach, who I'll talk about a little bit more. But I like all of those things. The one little nugget that's buried in there is the fact that he beats Ike Villanueva, who's moving up on incredibly short notice at heavyweight, and did crack him a couple of times. And then right after that, had a suspension for anastrozole, which is an estrogen blocker.
Don't love that.
He was relatively open about it, but you still don't like that USADA suspension. So that's why Sherman's been away for a bit, training out of a good gym. Now he's taking on a guy that's trained with JDS, that's training with Juan Espino, that's training with Nikita Krylov, and Andrei Arlovsky. And for Arlovsky, since he's kind of had that long losing streak, and then he's won some and lost some, but won more than he's lost, he's kind of reinvented his game a little bit to where he throws the leg kicks. He's the guy that checks the leg kicks, and he'll do it early. And the thing for Arlovsky is, he'll blitz quite a bit until he gets met with resistance, and then he'll stop and he'll kind of box a little bit more classically. So I do like this fight. I think stylistically it's great because Sherman, a lot of pressure, decent boxing, quite a bit of power for Arlovsky. Leaves a little bit off his shots, but he can land really good volume. And we even saw it with the pop, the Tanner Boser fight. And I went back and watched it, and I had to rescore it because I've been on the hill of Boser won that fight. I scored it 29-28 for Arlovsky when I watched it last night. And I thought Arlovsky won rounds 2 and 3. The blitzes worked great, and he had power in the shots.
Okay, so I'm going to agree with a lot of what you said, but just two key points. Chase Sherman's not a good boxer, I wouldn't say. Chase Sherman gets hit too much to be considered a good boxer, because this is my problem. If you're going to be considered a good boxer, defensively, you need to be very sound as well. And for Sherman, we've seen him be hittable throughout his career, and not really only in the UFC. Even go back to his Island fights. He got cracked in those fights. And yes, at heavyweight, anyone can get hit. It's one of those things, but it is a little bit concerning the fact that we have seen Sherman face adversity in a lot of his fights, even when it hasn't been against the upper echelon of competition. But Chase Sherman's got to be the happiest guy in the world right now, doesn't he? He went from fighting Parker Porter, a guy who, let's be honest, just doesn't have the most fanfare in the world, to Andrei Arlovsky, former champ, former gatekeeper, former top-tier fighter. But still, Andrei Arlovsky, like, getting a win over Andrei Arlovsky still means a lot to just kind of like the everyday MMA fan. It's not like you're beating just an unranked heavyweight. There's still a bit of prestige that comes with beating a guy like Andrei Arlovsky. So for Sherman, I'm sure we're getting the best version of him, at least on this short notice, if that makes any sense. This is the kind of fight that Chase Sherman can get motivated for, and that he should show up the best version of himself for. Now for Andrei Arlovsky, the blitzes are interesting because it will happen between rounds. Sometimes he'll be blitz heavy and some rounds he won't be, because it is weird. For Arlovsky, he's developed into much more of a pressure and volume fighter in the later stage of his career than that really aggressive power punching combination thrower in the earlier stage of his career. And even, I'll say, the second run in the UFC after he beat Brendan Schaub by split decision, even that version of Andrei Arlovsky was still an aggressive fighter, I would say. It's been after, you know, the Travis Brown win, that's when he started to fall off. After he did lose the fights to Overeem, Stipe, Francis, and Josh Barnett, those are tough guys to fight. And I do feel like that losing streak was really held against Andrei Arlovsky in kind of a disrespectful manner, because people were like, oh, he's completely shot. But when you look at the fighters we lost to, well, you get knocked out by Francis. I don't know if you know this, Craig, but a lot of people get knocked out by Francis Ngannou. It's just, Arlovsky's had a very strange second half of his career, because I wouldn't even say it's a second half. This is like the fifth rendition of Arlovsky that we've really gotten. And he has improved even at this stage of his career. I wouldn't say that he's learned new tricks between every single fight, but Andrei Arlovsky's in a weird stage where he might not still have a lot of the skills that got him to the top of the game, but he's got a lot of the weird veteran X factors that fighters who are now at his stage in the rankings, or at least no longer in the rankings, don't normally have. Like for Arlovsky, when he gets hurt in fights, he knows what to do. He can stay on the outside. He can turn into more of a boxer than a puncher, and he can avoid some of the big shots. I like that. That's something you don't often see from fighters moving up the rankings. But my problem is that Arlovsky can't really eat those shots anymore. It's weird, because I don't want to say he has bad volume, just because he has a really high output, so it's not like he's getting tired because he's not doing a lot in his fights, but he can be held to a lower volume if you do pressure him a lot. If you can pressure Andrei Arlovsky and take away some of the footwork of him, it won't allow him to blitz in, and it forces him to become a defensive fighter. And if Chase Sherman can force Andrei Arlovsky to become a defensive fighter, it means that He's just not going to get out-volumed himself. So really, the X-factor for Arlovski is, if he can move forward and just out-volume Chase Sherman, I don't think Arlovski can knock out Sherman. I don't. I think Sherman has a good chin, although he is hittable. But Arlovski can just overwhelm him. And on the flip side, if Sherman can hit him with some of those leg kicks, I know Arlovski checks them, and good job breaking that down, because that's one of the things I was going to mention. I was going to be like, they both throw leg kicks, but only one's good defensively. But Arlovski, yeah, it's weird. Because he has all these veteran X-factors right now, but he doesn't really have a lot of the skills that really were developed to get him those X-factors in the first place. So this is a really interesting matchup, and I think this is a crossroads fight more than any other on this card.
100%. I mean, looking at it for Sherman, I talked about it, but Coach Justin Houghton is the coach. Former Glory fighter, striking coach with Elevation, but he's the P4P or pound for pound guy. And listen, we've had fighters from that gym that are competing on this card. Lupi Godinez is somebody that trains there. We've seen Tisha Torres kind of between the two of them. And for Chase Sherman, again, let's see what he comes out with. I'm really excited to see what version of Chase Sherman we get, because by and large, it's been pretty much the same version every single fight in, fight out. Against Villanueva, you had to expect, listen, the guy was a former champion from another organization, multiple different weight classes. He'd taken a fight not that long ago at middleweight, and he was coming up at heavyweight. He was like 223 with quite a bit of pudge to him. And listen, he was able to crack Sherman, but a big difference maker in that one was the leg kicks to Sherman early on. So it'll be interesting to see what he can kind of bring together for Arlovski. And for Arlovski, I look at the last three fights, and that's where it's interesting. So breakdown 2020. He fights teammate Felipe Lins, and he beats him. Lins looked bad.
Awful.
Like, looked really bad. He fights Tanner Boser, and that's where I want to break it down. There's the Boser fight, and there's the Aspinall fight. Are they the same fight or no? And they fight very differently. But in the fight against Boser, Andre Arlovski threw under 10 strikes in the first round. He didn't throw hardly anything. He got leg kicked, what have you. Boser won the first round. Second round is when the blitzing started, when the striking started from Arlovski. He was able to crack Boser at the end of the first round with one clean right hand. And that was when it was like, okay, I can strike with this guy. And now I'm going to start to do it. Second round, he did well. Third round, he did really well. And then he goes in the Aspinall fight, and it was right off the bat. Pressure, and he went and blitzed, and he got caught by Aspinall, and then he stopped blitzing.
Okay,
again.
This is the only thing I'm going to throw in. It's not just about the blitzing. Tom Aspinall's a lot better than Tanner Boser, and he's a much more well-rounded and a much more technical striker than Tanner Boser. This is my problem. Much more technical. It's not really close when it comes to the boxing, because the thing that Aspinall can do is, when he gets on the inside of your punches, he's really good at how far away he is when he lands his shots. The problem that Boser was landing into was, when he was eating the shots, he wasn't balanced in the fight, and that's what made it look like he was getting rocked. I don't really think it was Arlovski rocking Tanner Boser with the might of his punches. I think a lot of it had to do with the footwork of Arlovski kind of confusing Tanner Boser. And I do think Arlovski can kind of replicate that similar gameplay against a fighter like Chase Sherman.
If we look at one last stat, total average career fight time for Andre Arlovski, 8 minutes and 46 seconds. That is insane. If we have a look at the odds for this fight, Matt, we have Andre Arlovski coming in here as the favorite on short notice. He opened a minus 130. He's minus 137 at this point. For Chase Sherman, opened a plus 110. He's a plus 113. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, you have 944 total votes, 66% Arlovski, 69% by decision. For the 34% that have Sherman, 74% by knockout. Sherman, Arlovski on short notice. For Chase Sherman, he was originally going to be taking on a power puncher in Parker Porter, and now you get more of a volume guy in Arlovski. Interesting one.
So the one thing I do like about Arlovski is, although this is on short notice, he is, I will say, kind of well-known as one of those fighters who just stays in shape year-round. I'm not worried about Arlovski's cardio in this fight. I'm not worried about his just fitness, overall fitness level in this fight, because he is well-known as he's a fighter who likes to stay in shape year-round, and he's in the gym a lot. That's one thing I do like about Arlovski is, you do see fighters, and this is kind of a side note, fighters as they kind of age, they do become, I guess, just less motivated by the whole thing. You've already done this so many times. It kind of gets harder and harder to stay motivated. Andre Arlovski, he switches between gyms. He'll give different looks. He's just a guy who always has stayed a student of the game, and that's something that I do like to throw that out there. So, personally, for my pick, I'm actually picking Andre Arlovski. I did not think in the year 2021 I would ever pick Andre Arlovski again, but stylistically, I do think his volume is going to be a problem for Chase Sherman. Again, I don't think it's going to be the problem that he's going to go out there, hurt Sherman, then put him away up against the cage. I think that Andre Arlovski is long gone, but I do think Arlovski just the veteran savvy and the fight IQ will be enough to get him over the edge. I think Sherman is a good puncher, but he doesn't have enough power that I really worry about. And I know Arlovski's had a brittle chin, to say the least, in his past run. But the thing about Sherman is that he really needs to throw with a lot of combinations to get guys down. The first fight that always comes to my mind when I think Chase Sherman is that Rashad Coulter fight. What was his keys in that fight? A crap ton of leg kicks. Early adopter of the calf kick in the heavyweight division is Chase Sherman. And elbows over the top. But the elbows are set up by the volume and the combinations of Chase Sherman. So I do think this will be a very fun fight, but I do side with the fans. I think Arlovski's going to win by decision, but if Sherman wins, probably by knockout.
Yeah, for Chase Sherman, I mean, I look at it, and the way to beat him, you've almost got to finish him. Justin Ledette, good boxer, and I mean, now we're really trying to reach, because that was 4.5 years ago, but...
And a good boxer.
Justin Ledette was a good boxer at heavyweight, and that's how he was able to win out. Wald Harris, very powerful boxer. That's how he was able to win out. Rashad Coulter, very fun fight. Damian Grabowski, long in the tooth. You lose to Abdurakhimov. You lose to Justin Willis, who was in the top 10 at one point. You lose to Augusto Sakai, a finisher. Okay, that's going to happen. And then he gets booted out of the UFC. For me, Chase Sherman, if he's able to land the leg kicks, and Arlovski will check it early, and if he checks it, that usually almost stops the leg kick from a lot of fighters. Bozer was one of the few that would keep throwing it, but that's Bozer's MO. He's volume heavy and kick heavy. That's where I go with the difference of opinion on the Aspinall-Bozer. It's just the way that they fight. Aspinall is very much a boxer. Bozer is very much of a kickboxer. But that's neither here nor there. For Chase Sherman, I like the volume. And the weird thing with Sherman, if you look at the numbers, and you got to take them with a grain of salt based on competition, but his output and the level that he gets hit a lot. But compared to what Arlovski throws, Arlovski doesn't throw as much as the guys that are really tagging Sherman. That could definitely happen in this one, where, again, Arlovski has adopted a volume-heavy style at the end. But I think if Sherman pressure, 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 and if he's able to land some clean, hard shots, it's going to be a tough night for Arlovski behind the two black lines. That's usually, if you're going to beat him, that's the way to do it. I'm going to go with the underdog, Chase Sherman, here. You're going to go with the favorite, Andre Arlovski.
It's just tough to finish Arlovski, and I know that's been the narrative of, oh, Arlovski doesn't have a chin. The guys who are finishing him are the Tom Aspinalls, the Jerzy Rosenstrikes.
Running into him for a double leg takedown and just... sinking up a choke.
And he did crack him before that. And that's the thing about Aspinall. It's just his technical boxing on the outside and the inside is almost unparalleled in this division. I truly believe that. Tom Aspinall on the feet is a handful to deal with. And the fact that Arlovski couldn't get on the inside on Aspinall, I don't think that'll be the case in this fight. I do like Arlovski on the outside. I think his movement will give Sherman problems. But again, I could very likely see a world where Sherman wins by TKO, if I'm being honest. But I'll go Arlovski by decision.
Love the fight. We're split on the pick. Matt's going Arlovski. I'm going to go with Chase Sherman. Really fun fight. And we have two more great fights. You have Jakar Close taking on Jeremy Stephens, moving up back to lightweight. And in our main event, we have Robert Whittaker taking on Kelvin Gastelum, the long-awaited fight as it is. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Fight Night Picks is sponsored by Manscaped, the global leaders in men's below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels and is now available in the USA, Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and the European Union. We have an exclusive offer for our audience. Use the promo code FNP, get 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Join the movement and the other 2 million men who trust Manscaped. And Matt, did you know, and this one's going to be serious, that one guy every hour, every day is diagnosed with testicular cancer. So this is a reminder to all men listening to check yourself before you wreck yourself. Manscaped, in addition to providing the right tools and solutions for safe and easy manscaping, has partnered with the Testicular Cancer Society to spread awareness for men's health and early cancer detection. Together, TCS and Manscaped are committed to raising awareness for the most common form of cancer in men age 15 to 35. We're in that bracket. Some might not think it some days, and giving support for fighters, survivors, and families impacted by testicular cancer as a part of the We Save Balls initiative. While you're going down there cleaning up your sack, why not go ahead and give them a little investigation for lumps, changes in size, and or pain? I think we can all agree it's pretty fun playing with your balls anyway. Yikes, you heard me say that. That's part of the copy. That's part of what I just said. Manscaped recommends you check yourself once a month. If you do feel any lumps, swelling, give your doctor a call. Listen, it's pretty easy. If you do have any issues, make sure you make a call. It's as simple as that. In addition to checking yourself regularly, we also want you to make sure that your sack is looking fresh and clean with Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0. Inside the shed, which is a travel bag.
A nice one.
Everybody needs a nice one. You get the Lawnmower 3.0. What can we say? about the Lawnmower 3.0.
If you want rusty nuts, don't use it. But hey, that's not something you're in the market for. If you just want a really good trimmer that doesn't have a metal blade to it or edge, this is the one that you're looking for. And again, people like to get honest, hey, you guys are only saying this because they're a sponsor. No, we use the products all the time. Craig doesn't just use the nose hair trimmer on camera. We use all these products because they're actually really, really good.
There is the Weed Whacker. There's, of course, the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. You spray it on. It's like a spritz. They also have the great Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's like a salve. You know what I'm going to say. You slap that stuff on there. It does work great, but all the liquid formulations only use the best ingredients. Some of these liquid tools include what I've talked about, but they also have on their website. You can check it out there. You can use the promo code. You're still going to get the discount. They're a fine cologne. It smells great. It's a smell that you know and love from Manscaped. So make sure you check it out and join the Manscaped movement and start taking care of your balls today. Get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Always use the right tools for your family jewels. And like I said, this month they are helping out a great cause with TCS and the Testicular Cancer Society. It's an important initiative. Everybody knows somebody that has been affected by cancer. And this is one that's prevalent among males 15 to 35. It's right in the wheelhouse. So make sure you're checking out your balls while you're shaving your balls and using the promo code FNP at manscaped.com, 20% and free shipping. Matt, we got a big show to continue on with. Big co-main event, big main event. So as we always say with Fight Night Picks,
let's get into it.
Really liking our co-main event this weekend. We have Jeremy Stephens moving up to a division where he once roamed at lightweight, taking on the man himself, Jakar Close, a guy that was originally scheduled to be taking on Luis Pena just a few weeks ago, and all of a sudden he thrusts himself into a great opportunity, taking on Lil Heathen Jeremy Stephens. And if you look at the 5-on-in for both these guys, for Jakar Close, 3-2, you look at the names, maybe not as big as the names for Jeremy Stephens. Of course, for Stephens, I mean, he was a guy that was taking part in all-timers at 145 pounds. And for Stephens, Jose Aldo, Zabit, Yair Rodriguez, and Calvin Kattar. And listen, nobody liked the fight that Jeremy Stephens had where he's wearing the sunglasses and apologizing for getting irate. It happened. It was very unfortunate. It sucks that it did happen. But in this fight, Jeremy Stephens with the pressure, with the boxing, and Jakar Close with his well-rounded game, and sometimes he can wrestle and sometimes he can strike. And if he decides to strike, well, sometimes Beneil Dariush is going to knock his lights out, knock his head into the fourth, into the fourth row. So in a fight like this, it makes it incredibly interesting. Jakar Close has taken on some strikers, and he's done quite well with them. It's just, can he beat such a big name and a guy that has all the experience as Jeremy Stephens? I love the matchup, quite frankly.
I think this is a very, very fun fight. With Jeremy Stephens, you just kind of know that going into one of his fights. He loves to just move forward, not be sound defensively, and throw a bunch of bombs. And that's something I can get behind as an MMA fan. Now, for Jakar Close, the more technical out of these two guys, and I don't think I'm telling anybody something they don't know. For Close, it is interesting because I think of him as more of a boxer. He will throw a few kicks, good calf kicks. He doesn't throw enough of them, though, and that is one thing about Jakar Close's game that I do think he could improve on. He is a fighter who, it's weird what range he stands at, because he stands at kind of a longer range than you would expect for a primary boxer to stand at, and he can get eaten up with leg kicks at that range. Just one thing about Jakar Close's game that I'm not thrilled with, but he's great at counter-striking. He is really good at staying technical in the pocket, and I'm going to compare him a little bit to Calvin Kattar, the last opponent that Jeremy Stephens, of course, got knocked out by, but Close can replicate some of the things Calvin Kattar can do. Now, does he have the power Kattar does? No. Does he have sort of the speed, or at least hand speed of Calvin Kattar? No. I would say his ability to counter is about on par with Calvin Kattar's, though. I really do like the fact that Jakar Close does one thing well. He's got a great pullback, too. It's something that Conor McGregor, people love talking about him for, because what's he really good at? Gets out of the way, counters you with a straight shot. Jakar Close has that down. Now, of course, the best example of that had to be in a loss against Beneil Dariush, but what does he do in that fight? Against one of the best fighters in the world, he's able to counter a jab, crack him with a right hand, and you think, wow, Benil's on his way out of this fight. Now, we're not going to mention the overhand left and the 5 other strikes Benil landed, but still, Jakar Close has decent power in his hands. I wouldn't say great power by any means, and that's why I think this is a very fun fight. We have two guys known for the durability, although they have been finished. They are two very durable fighters who can keep a very hard and high output throughout 3 rounds, and that's why this should be a really fun fight. For Stevens, though, it will be interesting, because at one
145, he's been kind of the brute in a lot of his fights. He's been able to be the guy who can just walk forward, kind of bully guys up against the cage and throw a lot of power at them. Look at his past wins. The Head and Brow fight's one that comes to mind. Now, yes, Brow is a little bit smaller, but he was just coming off being champ at 135, and Jeremy Stephens beat the brakes off of him. Go back to the Gilbert Melendez fight. It was the leg kicks for the story of that fight. The Duo Choi fight, he looked good in, but he gets cracked. And that's the thing with Jeremy Stephens. It's not a Jeremy Stephens fight until he gets cracked, gets hurt, and then it becomes the real fight. Then he really starts to put pressure on his opponents. And even just go back to the Josh Emmett fight. Now, you got to talk to Josh Emmett after that fight, and he details some of the injuries he was dealing with after the fight against Jeremy Stephens. Jeremy Stephens put it on Josh Emmett like few people have. That was a very hard finish to watch, and that's the thing about Jeremy Stephens. Yes, he's at a bit of a downturn in his career, and yes, you might not think that this is the most dangerous fighter that you could be in there with, but when you're fighting, Jeremy Stephens is always that one shot away from being able to knock you out. That's the fun thing about a Jeremy Stephens fight.
Jeremy Stephens hasn't won a fight in over 3 years. That's insane. I mean, again, Aldo, Magomed Sharipov, Yair, and then Callum Cater. And again, the Yair fights, you had what? Less than a month between them. They were both main events. The second one was a 3-round main event. The first one was supposed to be 5. It was weird stuff. And he was booked against Cater earlier, and then they had to book it a little bit later. He was booked against Arnold Allen. That was supposed to happen back in November. That one didn't happen. Stevens was hurt. So now he comes into this fight with Chikara Close up a weight class. Now, he did miss weight in the Calvin Cater fight. By a lot.
And Calvin Cater was very upset about it and really wanted to go off on him. That one of the most unintentionally hilarious post-fight interviews, because Calvin Cater's walking over to Joe Rogan to talk into the mic, and then all of a sudden they like, Jeremy Stephens comes up and hugs him, and he's like, man, you're really good. And Calvin Cater, the first thing he says, he's like, I really wanted to get on the mic and rip him apart for missing weight, but like, I guess he's cool, so we're good now. But it is weird, because we've seen Jeremy Stephens in there with similar fighters to Chikara Close. Now, I do say that, but there is a bit of a caveat. When you've been fighting as long as Jeremy Stephens, you're going to see guys of every style. And that is the one thing Jeremy Stephens has the edge in over Chikara Close. He has experience like few other guys in the UFC. Jeremy Stephens has a record in the UFC that no one wants to be known for, but he is the one who owns it. He has the most losses in UFC history. Not really a record you want to be known for, but he's just been around for a long time. And I kind of call it the Matt Brown effect, because people are like, why do you like Matt Brown so much? His record's terrible. When you fought the best guys for 10 years, your record is not going to be pristine. You're going to have your lumps. And I do think that has been the case with Jeremy Stephens. Losing to Max Holloway, Frankie Edgar, and Jose Aldo, who cares? That's going to happen if you're around the division for long enough. The only thing that is concerning, though, is that in this last little losing streak of Jeremy Stephens, he accepts damage and he gets hurt by shots like he wasn't getting hurt by earlier on in his career. We've seen Jeremy Stephens get knocked down, I would say, earlier on in his career. I know the Eve Edwards knocked him out early on, but still. We've seen him get hurt to the body, hurt to the head, but he wasn't getting finished by those techniques. Then you go to the Aldo fight. Aldo hits him with two of the most vicious body shots I've ever seen in UFC history, finishes him. Yair Rodriguez, yes, it goes to the decision. Yair drops with a body kick. And then go to the Calvin Cater fight. Yes, he broke Calvin Cater's nose, but what was the last shot in that? He gets hit by an elbow, dropped, and then finished on the ground. The one thing that is concerning, at least in this stage of Jeremy Stephens' career, is he fights in the same way. He just can't take the damage the same way he was able to in his earlier UFC tenure.
So, for Chikara Close, biggest fight so far, Bobby Green, maybe? Like, that's really it. Benil, I mean, Lando Venata? Benil Dariush, I guess, but it's a loss. Oh, so sorry. It's really weird when you look at the wins. Mark Jacasey, he was undefeated at the time. That could be it. But it's really tricky to try and even pick one out. He lost to David Taymor. Watch your underwears. And then you look at this fight. He had Jai Herbert originally scheduled. Herbert's got a big fight coming up. He had Luis Pena. Now he gets Jeremy Stephens. This is the biggest fight. Win or lose, I mean, Benil Dariush, again, it was an interesting fight. It's a lot of fun if you want to go back and watch it, but he got finished in impressive fashion. That was early last year. He's had over a year to kind of take his lumps and get back and work with the team at Fight Ready MMA. Great team over there. We talked about them. They've had plenty of fighters on this card, but Santino DeFranco and crew, Eric Albert, seeing if he's over there, maybe get the Cejudos of the world.
Could.
The Pitbull brothers, all sorts of great training partners. And for Jeremy Stephens, he's been at Alliance Jump. He's been there forever.
Long time.
Dominic Cruz in the corner. Even lower weight class, but we'll get to that. Jeremy Stephens open to minus 110. He's minus 126 or thereabouts. For Chikara Close, open to minus 110. He's at a plus 103. The money has come in on Jeremy Stephens. If we look at the picks, over on Topology, 1,072 of them. 43% with Stevens, 68% of them have him to win by knockout, 57% of fans have Close, 79% by decision. So it's either Stevens finishes Close, or close just grinds out a decision win here.
It's interesting because I really can see it going either way. If I'm just the honest opinion, I could see Jeremy Stephens getting close back up against the cage, starting to land a lot of those low calf kicks like we know Stephens can, and then answering with power up top by throwing those big overhands and hooks like we know Jeremy Stephens can. The one thing about Close, he's great at keeping range. He doesn't have that high of an output. Now, I am going to picture Carl Close. That is my official prediction. But I'm going to warn everyone about one thing. It could be a split decision that he wins. And I only say that because Carl Close, he's a very good striker. He's a very technical striker. When you look at his highlights, it is him being aggressive. And a lot of his fights, he will just kind of stand on the outside and kind of wait for his opponent to throw. And then once they make their initial move, then he will react to it. So I can warn people, this might be a slightly boring fight than where our expectations are, but I am going to ever so slightly picture Carl Close. I think the range will give Stevens problems, and if Stevens does try to rush his way on the inside, I do think Close can catch him with a counter shot. Maybe not put him down, but we have seen Stevens susceptible to shots in the past. He might be able to hurt him with one of those shots, and then from there on, just pick him apart from the outside. So I'm going to picture Carl Close.
It's a really tricky one, because again, there's so many miles on Stevens, and there isn't on Close. Close is coming off a really, really bad loss, but it's been over a year. And same can be said just about for Jeremy Stephens. It's almost been a year since that fight against Cater. He had the injury that really kind of took him out and sidelined him. He was supposed to take on Arnold Allen back in November. So all of a sudden he comes into this fight up a weight class, and that's weird because you're supposed to take on Allen at 45 and now you're at 55 against Jacare Close. Why? Why from November to now are we making that move? It's just going to be interesting to see, because for Jeremy Stephens at 55, you look at some of the fights. Pettis, Cerrone,
RDA knocked out.
Danny Downs. He finished RDA, so there is
that. That was 10 years ago, though.
But that's the other thing. It was 10 years ago. I think it's a right step, especially for a guy like Stevens at this point. He's going to come in here at, what, 34, almost 35? So we'll see which Jeremy Stephens we get. It's a tricky one to pick, and you bring that up too. So I am ever so slightly going to go with the pressure of Jacare Close. I like him on the outside. I like the counter shots for Stevens. He can push a really good pace, and if he cracks Close, he could really hurt him and finish him. So if you do like Stevens, yeah, most likely by finish. And if you like Close, most likely by decision. I agree. So I do like Close by decision in this one. I'm ever so slightly going to go with the underdog here, and I'm going to pick the younger, not by much, Jacare Close to get the win. It's an interesting fight, though.
Hopefully we do get this at its best version, where it is Jeremy Stephens marching down Jacare Close and Close trying to land counter shots. That would be this fight at its best version, so hopefully that is what we get. But no, I agree. I'm expecting Close to win, probably by decision, but it should be a very entertaining fight.
Love the fight. Both going with fight ready, Jacare Close and Matt. We have a great main event on tap. You're not going to want to miss it. Robert Whitaker's take on Kelvin Gastelum. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight in our main event at middleweight. We have a fight that was supposed to take place years ago between the Reaper, Robert Whitaker, and the man himself, Kelvin Gastelum. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFNP. For the man to my left, your right, we have Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials just as easily at MattAllenFNP. As always, both of us at Fight Night Picks. And big time week coming up, headlined by our main event, Matt. Robert Whitaker really looked to be in a bad spot with that loss sandwiched in between all of his wins. You have that loss to Israel Adesanya where he gets finished, and it's really, what are we going to get out of Whitaker? He's only 30 at this point, but back then it was like, well, he's road worn. The wars against Yoel Romero. What are we going to get out of Whitaker? And so far in his last two fights, you look at them, Darren Till and Jared Cannonier. He looked really good. It's great to see Whitaker out of those. For Gastelum, you look at the five on in. Two wins sandwiched in between. You have a big old patty that is, well, three losses. And we didn't know what we were going to get out of Gastelum. Was his heart still in it? Holy smokes, was it ever. In his last fight against Ian Heinisch, it was back to basics. And he looked really, really good in that fight. So for these two guys, Gastelum, do you throw at all the losses? Well, not necessarily, but in that one Heinisch win, he looked very good. And for Whitaker, you throw out that Adesanya loss. It was a big moment for him. He loses. And in the Till fight, he looked good. And in the fight, in his last time out, he looked great against Jared Cannonier. Albeit, in those fights, or especially in that fight against Cannonier, was it a main event? Was it a five-round fight?
No, it was a co-main event.
Exactly. It was a co-main event. So he's back to the five-round atmosphere that he knows well. For Gastelum, he's fought his share of five-round fights. His best showing in a five-round fight Well, really, it ended very quickly. It was probably even the Bisping fight. I mean, a huge win in Shenzhen, China. He picked up a huge win there. And that's the thing. He beats Bisping. He beats Jacare. It was a close fight. He has his war against Adesanya. And from then, it was like,
Here's the thing, Craig, and I think you have to be honest to this. You give Kelvin Gastelum, you're hard on Kelvin Gastelum, let's just be honest. You've never picked Kelvin Gastelum to win a fight on this channel, I don't think. You do pick against him a lot. So, I guess I'll be Kelvin Gastelum's cheerleader for this fight. Now, I'm the biggest Robert Whittaker fan in the world. I'm only a fan of three fighters, and I can openly admit this right now.
Supposed to be an impartial media member.
I'm not a member of the media, Craig, you are. So, I like Robert Whittaker, Max Holloway, Dustin Poirier. Those are just easy fighters to like because they all have very entertaining fights. And that's the one thing about this fight that does worry me. I think Robert Whittaker is better than Kelvin Gastelum in pretty much every area of MMA, other than the wrestling, just because it's really hard to get the wrestling background if you're from Australia, unlike Kelvin Gastelum, who of course wrestled in high school and college. But for Whittaker, does he have good jiu-jitsu? Yeah, he does. And it's weird because Robert Whittaker is like Max Holloway, where he takes the coolest looking pictures wearing a gi, but you never see him do jiu-jitsu in fights. But you know that they are really good at it outside. And the weird thing about Whittaker, I always think of Eric Anders when I think of Robert Whittaker, because it is true. You think of, and you not only think, but you hear about how good they are in the gym with their grappling. You just aren't able to see that put into practice in the cage. But for Whittaker, we know the grappling's there. And then you want to talk about striking. His striking is as close to a 10 as you can be without a 10 being considered Israel Adesanya. He's a 9.99 out of striking. He really is. And for Whittaker, the great thing about him is his variety of shots. He can really throw anything at you. And the one thing I like about Whittaker, I like it, but I don't like it. And this is what I'm going to bring up, the Till and Cannoneer fight. Against Darren Till, he was hesitant. He was. I didn't think he looked good against Darren Till. And honestly, if you want to make a case that Darren Till won that fight, I'm not going to disagree with you, honestly, because I like Robert Whittaker a lot, and even I thought maybe Darren Till had won that fight. He got hurt in that fight, and the one thing that worries me about Robert Whittaker is southpaws have been able to hurt him, and it hasn't always just been southpaws. Left-sided attacks can catch Robert Whittaker. You look at Darren Till, he caught him with an elbow on the way in. You look at Adesanya, he catches him with a left hook. It's just something that I'm a little concerned about. I'm not saying it's going to show up in this fight, but when you're dealing with a southpaw with really good hand speed and really good power in Kelvin Gastelum, those are holes in Robert Whittaker's defense that I'm going to look for.
Kelvin Gastelum's one of those guys. He's not big for 85. He was a former welterweight. So is Whittaker, former welterweight that really found his home and all of his success at 85. Almost like Rumble Johnson. Didn't do it at 70. Didn't really do it at 85. 205 was his calling. For Gastelum, is he too small of a guy at middleweight? Maybe. I'm not going to say that. He has a great nutritionist as his girlfriend. We saw that all over the posters the last time out and in the embeddeds in his last fight taking on Ian Heinisch. Well, Ian Heinisch got worked out in the back by a guy in jeans and no t-shirt. It was really, really
weird.
It was
so weird.
Ian, how do you feel? Is this positionally good?
Is this okay for you, Ian?
And for Ian, it was weird for him too because his fight before, the Gerald Meerschaert fight, he was Bangkok ready. He was training out of Thailand. His last time wasn't able to do that, but also wasn't able to get back at elevation, so he's kind of like working out.
You're already doing it, Craig. Stop.
Keeping steady.
No, you can't say that Kelvin Gastelum has never had a good win in the UFC because I see where this is going.
Let's get into Kelvin Gastelum's career. What is this guy good at? Does he throw a lot of kicks? Not a ton of kicks, but what he does is box inside to perfection. And his boxing in close is some of the best that you're going to find in all of MMA. And it's wrestling. His wrestling was good early on, but then his striking really caught up and he became a great striker. In his last fight, we get to see everything that is Kelvin Gastelum, and he looked amazing against Ian Heinisch.
He really did, and that's the thing about Kelvin Gastelum. Everyone wants to talk about the boxing or the cardio or the hand speed. He's a very well-rounded mixed martial artist. He isn't. I know you're going to talk about the loss to Jack Hermanson. That's the one loss that, yeah, he did look really bad in, but I think every MMA fighter has that one loss that they'd love to take back. If every Dustin Poirier fight, we kept on bringing up the fact that he lost to Michael Johnson, you guys would be tired of it, because there are some losses in guys' careers that I think you can throw out. I think that was a weird position against an awkward fighter that he wasn't ready for, and I think it was as simple as that. I really do. And here's the great news. I don't really think you could take a lot from the Marshman fight, and or not the Hermanson fight, sorry, and take that and look at what Robert Whittaker's going to do to Gastelum and think anything similar is going to happen. The thing about Whittaker that I do think will pay huge dividends in this fight is his speed advantage on the outside. Now, on the inside with hands, I do favor Kelvin Gastelum. I do think his boxing will give Robert Whittaker just weird trouble. I do. I think Kelvin Gastelum's technically very, very sound, and he's good defensively. And I know he has got hit in his previous fights. I know he's been hit by Adesanya.
Dropped by Adesanya.
But other than Adesanya, Kelvin Gastelum is one of the best chins, I'd argue, ever in MMA. I really do have Kelvin Gastelum in that, like, Vicente Luque chin area, because you can hit him with absolute bombs, and the majority of the time, he just walks right through it. Like, you can beat Kelvin Gastelum. I'm not saying he's the perfect fighter, but it's very hard to beat Kelvin Gastelum, and even when you do it, you're going to get damaged while you do it, and that's the only thing that worries me. Robert Whittaker, you kind of mentioned it. Yeah, he's only 29. Yeah, he's had a lot of 30, sorry. Yeah, he's had a lot of hard fights in the past. That's the one question mark that I don't really know about. Is Robert Whittaker shop-worn, and if so, to what degree? Of course, he's not like BJ Penn. Like, if Robert Whittaker fought a guy outside of a bar, I would bet every dollar I have Robert Whittaker could beat him. But the issue is, in his last few fights, we have seen him get dropped. Darren Till was able to drop him, and then he hurt him at the end of the fight as well. Jared Cannonier, people try to say Whittaker got hurt in that fight with that weird jab. I've watched the fight about 90 times, and like Luke Thomas with Max Holloway and Volkanovski too, he didn't. He just got hit by a weird shot. It kind of phased him, but he was good. But then you look, Adesanya drops him, Yoel drops him, Till drops him. Kelvin Gastelum has power, and he has very good power at that. If he's able to hurt Robert Whittaker, does Whittaker still have the recovery in the chin to take those big blows from Gastelum? So for me, this fight is a big question mark of where is Robert Whittaker's durability? Because if we're just looking at the X's and O's, well, if Whittaker stands on the outside in this fight and doesn't get brought into a brawl, I'm pretty confident he could win. Like, Robert Whittaker, great movement on the feet. That's one thing we haven't talked about. His back and forth, like, weird shift. Robert Whittaker, he's not really a karate fighter, and he's not really a boxer. He's this cool kind of fusion of the two where he can incorporate a lot of kicks into his game, but sometimes he can just go punch heavy. And you see the boxing of Whittaker is still very technically sound.
Great combinations from not just Robert Whittaker, and that's going to be the focus from a lot of people out there. The one thing, does he dip his head a little bit when he gets out of it? You know exactly what it's going to be. It's the same thing with Lupe Godinez on this card. 1-2 down the pipe, continues the forward motion, great jab. Robert Whittaker does a lot of things very well. In similar regard, it's just at the very highest level against the best competition. Robert Whittaker's takedown defense, very, very, very good. Legendary. Some would say legendary, especially in MMA, and that's a thing. Very good, very technically proficient. Is he one of those guys that I almost have in that like Anderson Silva category of, well, if it goes to the ground, is he good at the ground? Probably, yeah.
He's good at everything else.
Just don't see it very often. But you know that technically he's going to be quite adept. You know who he's going to have in his corner traveling with him. Jacob Malkoon. Oh, they made you pay for that Phil Hawes fight. But you got the fight out of Whittaker that ended up quite well. So if I do look, Matt, at the odds for this fight, Robert Whittaker is a decent favorite at this point. He opened up at a minus 275. He's a minus 264. Some money has come in on Gastelum. Gastelum opened a plus 220. He's a plus 211 right now. If we look at the Tapology votes, and again, full transparency, I don't look at these before we start these videos. So it's a surprise now. Oh, man. 1,139 of them, 92% Whittaker, 70% by decision. The 8% that I've Gastelum, 63% by knockout. That's fine. That's fair. Gastelum could do it. I think this is going to be an absolute war of attrition. I love the matchup. If you like Gastelum and Adesanya, if you like Whittaker, I don't know, against Till, let's not talk about Adesanya or Romero. I think you're going to get a great fight here. I love this for both guys. For Whittaker, originally supposed to take on Paulo Costa, probably title eliminator for this one. It's weird because it probably isn't. I love the fight. What's the pick at the end?
So my official pick, I am going to pick Robert Whittaker. I am ever so slightly going to pick him. And I understand, in the Tapology breakdown of the votes, the majority of the people who are picking Gastelum are picking him to win by TKO KO. And that makes sense. I'm not saying Whittaker's chinny. It's just I have seen him get dropped by very heavy-handed strikers. Think about Whittaker, though. He has great recovery. He's not a guy... There's fighters who, when they get dropped, they can never really get back into the fight after they do get hurt. And they're so tentative from that point on. Bobby Knuckles over here, War Knuckles, that's when the fight kind of starts. He gets dropped, and then he gets better because of it. It's like, oh, okay, I can eat your power. Now I can move forward comfortably. And if he is moving forward, using his combinations like getting against Jared Cannonier, another southpaw, very heavy-handed striker. Might not have the hand speed of Kelvin Gastelum, but still, there are a few parallels there. I do like Robert Whittaker. I think, yeah, if he can move forward and land in combinations, the kicks of Whittaker are absurd. And if he's able to land that 1-2 head kick on Gastelum, it's probably going to put him away.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of tough to get caught up in the noise because for Whittaker, former champ, he was the guy that, was it the Whittaker era? Like the Machida era? Maybe not, but you have to like the wins that he has in his back pocket. For Gastelum, he's had so many close fights, so many tough fights. That Adesanya fight, a fight of the year. And then the bookend of the losses, the Hermanson one, man, like... Ugh, you hate it, but he did come back better than ever in the fight against Ian Heinisch. And listen, is Ian Heinisch a great fighter? I don't know. He's a good fighter. I do know that. And it was a quality win for Gastelum. You can't take that one away from him. But again, I agree with you. It's not an ever so slight edge for me. I do like Whitaker in this fight quite a bit. And I know a lot of people out there do too. If you go into the YouTube community tab, you can vote for it. If you go over to our Instagram on Saturday before question mark kicks, you can vote for it. We talk all about it. Maybe there's some picks that we change. Maybe there's some fights that we kind of rack our brains around. The weight cut for Abdulrazak Al-Hassan, what does it look like over on Friday. But for me, I'm in agreement here. I do like Whitaker.
Again, here's another little thing that I've never forgot about. And again, if I think about it, I feel like I'd tell you guys. Kelvin Gastelum almost missed weight against Michael Bisping. I know it was at middleweight. I know he's never missed weight at middleweight. I still don't think this weight cut's that easy for Kelvin Gastelum, even though he is a small fighter for this division. It doesn't make any sense to me, but it has been, I don't want to say a disturbing trend in the past, but it has been a trend that Kelvin Gastelum, I don't know what it is. I'm not even going to speculate, but he has a hard time making weight in either division. Just kind of look out for that, because I don't even think this weight cut's easy for Kelvin Gastelum. And the last point, you had kind of mentioned how Whitaker was a welterweight moving up to middleweight. The difference between these two is Robert Whittaker could never make 170 again. Physically, he has really built himself into a middleweight, and to the point where when he was fighting Yoel Romero, who's a massive middleweight, they matched up pretty similarly. Like, Robert Whittaker's a big jack guy at middleweight, whereas Kelvin Gastelum, you look at him, I think Kelvin Gastelum could probably make 170 again in his career. I might not recommend it. I don't know how hard that weight cut is. I'm sure it's not
easy. You just said it was.
No. I just don't think he's a fighter who is in the best physical shape for his division. I think Kelvin Gastelum could become a better fighter at middleweight if he did retool a few things in his camp. But again, he could go out there and finish Whitaker. That's the one caveat, but yeah, I like Whitaker.
Can the Rafael Cordero plan work out? It has for a lot of fighters recently. We'll see if it will for Kelvin Gastelum, but we're both going with Robert Whitaker. Make sure you check out Fighting Picks question mark kicks at the end of the week. It's 2 hours before the prelims every Saturday where you get a final opportunity to make our final picks. And you get to go off of those for the week. I offer up the Fight Night Picks question mark kicks parlay. And oh boy, been knocking those ones out of the park. So I can't wait for that. We got great content lined up for this week. Already a lot of good interviews banked. You've got the one for Tony Gravely out already. I already teased Kai Kamaka, but I've got some Bellator stuff coming up with some really big fighters. So can't wait for it. Make sure you check out that stuff. We got some great stuff this week as well, outside of just the predictions. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it.